Morning, everyone, and welcome to this Citizens Board meeting of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on Tuesday, July 22nd, 2014. I'd like to call the meeting to order. And just a brief introductory remarks about today's meeting. Two of our board members are connected by phone today. Mr. Ibarra, would you identify yourself on the phone, please?
Sure. David Ibarra, board member representing the State Pipe Trades Association.
Thank you. And Ms. Hang.
Good morning, everyone. This is Paku Hang. I apologize. I can't be there in person.
Thank you. Because of matters before the board today, we need to have a quorum for some of our decision items. And so when we come to motions and votes, I'm going to call on the board members that are on the phone specifically to identify their votes so that it can be recorded for the record. Also, for anyone in the room who will be providing comments before the board today, testimony or otherwise, presentations, we will need you to be at the microphones because the only way the participants on the phone will hear your voice is to be amplified, and that will pick up. Also, the meeting is normal as usual being webcast, so this is I think a first for the agency to have a board meeting with Dr. Foley is shaking his head. I yield to my institutional memory to my right, and we will we'll hear another story maybe when we get to items from board members. Thank you. So with that, I call for a review of the agenda and a motion to approve and adopt the agenda.
So moved.
Motion by Dr. Foley, second by Mr. Riddle. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Ms. Hang?
Aye. Aye.
Mr. Ibarra?
Aye.
Thank you. Let's move on to the approval of minutes. And look at the minutes, board members, of June 24th, 2014. If there are any corrections or additions to the rules, please, or to the minutes, please offer them. Otherwise, I'd look for a motion to approve. Motion by Mr. Riddle to approve. Second?
Second.
Second by Dr. Foley. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Ms. Hang?
Aye.
Mr. Ibarra?
Aye.
The minutes are approved. Thank you. Moving on to the election of a vice chair. It has annually we need to the commissioner of the agency serves as chair of the board of the citizens board. We need to elect one of the other citizen board members as vice chair annually, and so that's today's job. Board members, do you have any nominations?
Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Foley.
I nominate Dr. Drager.
Dr. Foley nominates Dr. Drager. Other nominations?
Mr. Chairman.
You need to turn your mic on.
I move that nominations be closed.
Dr. Foley has moved that the nominations be closed. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Dr. Sampson. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none. Board members, Dr. Drager, I'm just looking to you for a nod that you accept the nomination. Thank you very much. She does. Ms. Hang and Mr. Ibarra, she nods her head in acceptance of the nomination. All those in favor of Dr. Catherine Drager as the vice chair, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Ms. Hang?
Aye.
Mr. Ibarra?
Aye.
Any opposed? Same sign. Hearing none. Congratulations again, Dr. Drager, for your role as vice chair. Now I'd like to move on to the legal report. Ms. Olson.
Thank you, Chair, board members. I have nothing to report today. However, I will be giving you a presentation later before the decision item.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. That concludes the legal report. My report today, just one quick item. I wanted to report on the meeting that will be coming up at the end of July. I'll be going out to Washington, D.C. for a full-day meeting with my peers from other states. The Environmental Council of States is hosting a one-day session on the EPA's proposal for rules under the Clean Water or Clean Air Act under Section 111D on expanded power plant sources of emissions, and there will be a full-day session, probably about 40 or so speakers throughout the day. It's a very interactive session. I'll be moderating the last panel of the day. If you have not seen the article that came out last week in the New York Times on this subject, I recommend it to you. We can forward that to you, but it was basically saying while other states are lamenting the 111D rules, Minnesota has made progress on reducing greenhouse gas emissions and carbon. And how did that happen in Minnesota? And sort of goes into some discussion of that. So I'll be attending that meeting. There are 150 people registered. It's the largest single-day event they've had for an ECOS meeting yet. It looks like all 43 member states are planning to attend, which is also unusual for the middle of the summer. So it should be an interesting day. Janet McCabe, the acting administrator for AIR, will be presenting on the 111D rule, and there'll be a number of perspectives given from industry, from the utilities, from non-governmental sectors, from number of lawyers. I'm sure we'll be talking about potential lawsuits and so forth. So it's really a day dedicated to the new proposed rule and what state perspectives on those rules are becoming. So with that, Dr. Foley.
Do we have a state assessment on the overall effect of those changes as proposed?
At this time, Dr. Foley, we do not have our we have not completed our review of the draft rule. Frank Kolash and our staff are working on that. Before we submit comments to the EPA, which will be due later this, I think in October is the date that they're actually somewhere on the 1st or 2nd of October, our comments will be due. So we'll probably have that on our agenda before that meeting so we can provide board members with background on how we what our take on the impact and scope of those rules are. There's still a number of questions that we're trying to analyze in terms of how the assumptions were made for the calculations of carbon emission reduction rates. Yes, Dr. Foley.
Could you speak on the governor's statement that came out relative to coal-burning power plants for Minnesota and if we don't have an assessment on that rule, et cetera, what was his overall thinking related to that statement?
Last Thursday, the governor spoke at an event, a half-day event that was hosted by the University of Minnesota, and was held at the McNamara Center. It was largely sponsored by the Department of Employment and Economic Development and other state agencies, Department of Commerce, looking at a clean energy economy for Minnesota and talking about work that the Department of Commerce has been doing. It's sort of laying out a blueprint for what the economic future of the state looks like. The governor's remarks came at the beginning of that meeting. They were setting a tone for the day, kind of launching the conversation. This is now the second time I've heard the governor make the statement that in an ideal world, Minnesota will be fossil fuel free at some point in the future. And he talked about eliminating coal. His challenge to the group was, what would a future look like? Well, how long would it take us, and how would we achieve that future? It was he framed it in the reference that he can see a day in the future where coal is no longer a power plant fuel for Minnesota, but he doesn't know what it will take to get us there. So his charge to the group was, and that was not widely reported, was how will we achieve that future? And so I think his objective in saying it, as I've heard him speak it before, is he really wants to engage the industry, folks from power generation sector as well as other sectors, and what would a future mix of energy sources look like in Minnesota, and how will we get there, and how long will it take us to eliminate coal? There were a lot of interesting, it was a very interesting day. I would say that the first panel of the day that involved a gentleman from Mortenson Construction, a sustainability manager from 3M, and I'm blanking out on the other participants, but the panel really got into some details on how quickly the change has come to Minnesota in terms of renewable energy sources, wind, and how the affordability of wind and solar is coming down quickly. So that was kind of cast out there as sort of a five-year snapshot. Most of the references used were from 2009 or 2010, and the changes in the cost of renewable energy sources and the sort of the sustained base load that wind is now providing for the upper Midwest grid is significant. So there is a lot of really interesting information. The PowerPoint presentations from that will be available. We'll make sure that board members, you can see those and when they're produced. I found it to be a really informative day, very helpful. The room was at capacity, probably a couple hundred people, and really a lot of industry and non-governmental sector folks talking to each other about collaborating on a clean energy future, which will be good for clean air in our state. So that ends my report, board members. Moving on, I'd like to ask if there are any items from board members. Start with Ms. Hang. Anything that you'd like to bring to the board?
Not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ibarra?
Nothing. I just would like to say thank you for allowing me to participate by phone. I'm not able to make it, obviously, and this is an important issue, so I want to be able to participate. One request I would ask, there were a couple statements that were made by other board members that I wasn't able to hear very well. So please try and remember to speak into the microphone when other board members are speaking. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryder. Duly noted, and Dr. Foley has a sheepish look on his face. Chair's prerogative, I guess, Dr. Foley. No, any other items from board members? Mr. Riddle.
Yes, thank you. I have two items. One is I'm hearing a lot of concern in the countryside, especially amongst farm groups, the county association, about the EPA's proposed rule changes, specifically on the definition or clarification of waters of the United States. And there's, you know, I don't know, misinformation or just a perception out there that this is an overreach and will include dry runs and catch ponds and things which have never been regulated by EPA before. And I'm just wondering, you know, what this agency's kind of messaging or update on that issue, or if you foresee the EPA doing any further outreach or clarification, because there's growing, you know, discontent about this.
Yeah, the one thing, Mr. Riddle, I can say in my experience in 35 years working with regulatory matters on waters of the state is that I'm thankful that we have a definition in statute that is waters of the state. Because waters of the U.S. has been litigated and confounded mostly over the years by a variety of cases, that the goal, I know, of the EPA was to clarify that scope of jurisdiction of theirs under the Clean Water Act. They also have used, there's been confusion over the years because of the 1899 Rivers and Harbors Act, which set navigable waters as a definition that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers used way back when they were trying to define jurisdiction for navigable waters. And so there has been just an abundance of confusion. I would agree with that. One of the things that our agency uses the Clean Water Act definition waters the U.S. for is obviously jurisdictional matters related to our 401 water quality certification job. So our scope of our interaction in terms of the EPA's jurisdiction has some boundaries on it. I would say that we have taken a fairly low-profile approach to commenting on any of the rule because the history of that definition, I would say, needs more debate before the EPA could successfully adopt a rule. I seriously doubt whether they'll get a rule adopted on it. I would expect that it might take more time to develop that rule. So this isn't based on something I've heard from the EPA, but I would suggest that the EPA is probably not going to quickly adopt the rule based on the comments and the confusion that the rule has created or just sort of acknowledged, in my view. It was out there to begin with, and now people are using it for other purposes. I think they're going to take more time. We can give board members a little brief update on that matter, and Assistant Commissioner Flood is in the room somewhere. I believe there she is. We'll make sure that we follow up with you on sort of the timeline and the scope of the rule and a little bit of background so you understand what the agency's role in interacting with Waters of the U.S. is. It has a much broader set of implications than just the Pollution Control Agency's job. Dr. Foley.
Yeah, I'm glad Mr. Ritter brought that up, and you commented also on the navigable water issue because it brings in many more federal agencies, as you've indicated, that I've heard the same concern. So I think maybe Assistant Commissioner Flood could also comment on that navigable water issue because that's a really big deal also. It just brings in a lot of other federal agency controls that I'm sort of in the dark on where they're going, and I think it would be helpful.
So we'll plan on that, Dr. Foley. Thank you. The other thing I just should mention that I have heard the EPA administrator repeatedly state that it was not EPA's intention to expand the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act or their authority by this rule. Some people are making that statement publicly, that they're expanding their jurisdiction.
Right.
That was not their intention. So when we come back and present this, I guarantee we will also have a lawyer helping with that presentation, heads up to our staff on that, because this is one of the most litigated terms and jurisdictions in across the country when it comes to the sweep of water regulation. As I said, the good news in Minnesota is we have a pretty solid statute when it comes to jurisdiction of the state, and that has been helpful in administering various programs. Mr. Riddle, any additional items?
Yeah, thank you for that. Yes, at our June 24th meeting, at the very end of the meeting, we heard from Paula McAbee representing Water Legacy and Catherine Hoffman representing MCEA about water quality standard variances in regards to mining. And they raised some very significant concerns and issues. And I'm just wondering what the agency's response is to the concerns that were raised and if we will be hearing more in an official response or hearing. This certainly is a big issue up north with the consideration of expansion of mining when we are hearing about existing mines not being in compliance or operating under very old permits. So,
thank you, Mr. Riddle. And yes, we've the presentation and when I actually Ms. McAbee submitted a request to bring the matter to the board meeting this month, and we're not doing that today, obviously. We are preparing and reviewed the tape of the June board meeting just to make sure I understood what I had said at the end of their testimony. And what I had said was that we would have staff prepare a written response for board members to understand the context of the issue around the variances and terms of permits that were brought up in the discussion, and that we would prepare that memo and deliver it to board members, and then we would decide whether or not a discussion before the board was appropriate based on the board's desires after reviewing that memo. So the staff are working on that right now. It's going to take some time because, as you mentioned, Ms. McAbee and Ms. Hoffman raised a number of questions and comments that we want to make sure we thoroughly respond to. So that's the status on that one. It will. I don't know the date that we'll get that memo produced, but we're working on it. If it's done before the board packet goes out for the next meeting, then it would be something we could have in your packet. It might go out before that or after that. It's just going to depend on time to get it all prepared.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Other board members have any items to bring up? Dr. Sampson.
Just one brief thing, and thank you for asking that question, Mr. Riddle. I appreciate that. You anticipated one of mine, but I just wanted to mention that I was unable to be here last month, so in preparation I watched the meeting also on video, which is a really good exercise and resource for the public, I think, as well, in terms of communicating what happens and having a great archive. I would also suggest to the board members that occasionally it is instructive to watch one of the meetings to see how we conduct ourselves. So I thought it was really interesting from that and that perspective as well. And also just from a kind of a bring it home sort of thing, I just wanted to take a minute to thank the people behind the scenes for making it possible, because it's not easy to get all of this technology to talk to itself and be streamed on the web. So I just want to thank all our technical experts for getting that done as well. So that's
thank you for the shout out to the PCA staff, Dr. Sampson. We appreciate that. Other board members have any items to bring forward? Seeing none. Let's move on to our info item, informational items. And first up, we have an update on our small municipal separate storm sewer systems. MS4 is the abbreviation for that, for our general permit coverage. And to start us off will be the division director for our municipal division, Mark Schmidt, and he'll also have Scott Fox joining him to present. Board members, this came up before the agency board last year, and there was a significant testimony from municipalities about implementation of this MS4 permit, and we thought we'd provide this update today. Welcome to the board, Mr. Schmidt. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name's Mark Schmidt. I'm the director of the municipal division, and on my right is Scott Fox, senior hydrologist of the stormwater section. And the subject of our informational board item today is our state municipal separate storm sewer system permit, which we commonly refer to as the MS4. The purpose of the MS4 is to regulate the discharge of municipal stormwater runoff. There are currently 233 municipalities and other public entities that are regulated under the MS4 permit. Many of you were members of the board in May of 2013 when you authorized us to reissue the most recent version of the MS4. And as I'm sure you recall, the reissuance of the permit was controversial. To make that long and complicated story short, suffice it to say that the regulated community found the requirements in the proposed MS4 permit to be burdensome and went to great lengths to prevent the agency from reissuing it. The result was that the draft MS4 had to be placed on public notice multiple times. It had to withstand multiple contested case hearing requests. It had to endure a request for a stay of the board decision to reissue it, and required a level of dialogue between the agency and the regulated community of such intensity that it took approximately three years to get the permit reissued. Ultimately, the board did authorize reissuance of the MS4, but it was contingent upon a delayed effective date and a commitment on the part of the MPCA to provide technical assistance and outreach that was sufficient to address the concerns of the regulated community. So our purpose here today is simply to update the board on those technical assistance and outreach commitments that we made to the regulated community. And so, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, with your permission, I'll yield the mic to Mr. Fox, who's prepared a presentation that covers that material.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Welcome to the board, Mr. Fox. Please proceed. And board members, because we have board members on the phone today, what I would appreciate is that we get through the presentation and then ask questions so that there's not sort of a interrupted flow. I'm not sure that Ms. Hang can see the slides, for example, and so we want to just be sort of intentional about how we get through the presentation and then ask any questions, if we would, please. Thank you. Welcome to the board, Mr. Fox. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Scott Fox. I'm a hydrologist with the stormwater section. I was one of the staff that worked on processing applications and extending coverage to communities regulated by the MS4 permit. I am here today to provide the board with an overview of MPCA staff's activities and progress related to permitting communities under the reissued permit. The areas that I would like to cover today include providing a brief overview of the MS4 program, describing our preparation for the MS4 application review process, giving you the status of permit coverage, and describing the resources and outreach efforts that are underway to assist MS4 permittees to further develop their stormwater programs. The areas identified in red on this map show where our permittees are located. MS4 permittees are all either municipalities or other public facilities. The criteria to be eligible for the MS4 program is largely based on urbanized area as defined by population density or on the potential for a community to have a stormwater discharge to an impaired water. The goal of the MS4 program is to reduce or prevent pollutants in stormwater from discharging to surface waters. The MS4 permit addresses this goal by requiring that regulated communities develop a stormwater pollution prevention program, which minimizes the discharge of pollutants to their stormwater conveyance system. The MS4 permit requires the following 7 components be incorporated into a community's stormwater pollution prevention program: a program to educate the public about the potential environmental impacts of stormwater and develop strategies to engage the public and get them involved in issues related to stormwater management. Procedures must be established to identify and prohibit illicit discharges from entering their stormwater conveyance system. A program to enforce erosion and sediment controls at construction sites. The long-term management of stormwater must be addressed by developing a program to ensure that specific permanent treatment standards are met for new development and redevelopment projects. A program of pollution prevention strategies must be developed and implemented for their municipal operations. And finally, for those permittees that are identified in an approved TMDL, the MS4 permit requires them to develop a strategy and to begin implementing BMPs to address their assigned waste load allocation. The board's decision to reissue the permit on May 22, 2013, with an effective date of August 1, 2013, gave permittees between 5 and 7 months to submit their applications. Following the permit reissuance, MS4 staff finalized plans to hold a series of workshops around the state. The purpose of these workshops were to explain the application form and permitting process and provide a format for communities to give community assistance with filling out their applications and to ask questions. In all, 10 workshops were held at the identified locations between August 6th and October 24th, 2013. During the workshops, MPCA staff requested feedback from attendees and made modifications to the workshops based on this feedback. In all, a total of 189 individuals attended one of the 10 workshops. As part of our application review, all applications and correspondence were managed electronically, which helped us streamline our review process. Particular areas of efficiency were achieved regarding the time and resources needed to send correspondence and our public notice process. This helped us conduct all completeness reviews within 30 days and achieve a 90-day average for permit coverage, which is well below the permitting goal of 150 days. A significant amount of paper was also saved as part of this process. It should be noted that our permitting process includes a 30-day public notice for each application, and the 30-day and the 90-day permit coverage average includes the time for the public noticing applications. Regulated communities are now in the process of revising their stormwater programs to meet the new requirements of the permit. I would like to provide a brief overview of the guidance, resources, and outreach efforts which MPCA staff has developed to assist communities with their program updates. The reissued MS4 permit requires communities to further develop their stormwater program regarding construction site stormwater controls and to meet permanent stormwater treatment standards for development projects. The MPCA staff has developed guidance documents for both of these areas to assist communities in meeting this new requirement. For those communities that have an approved TMDL, the reissued permit requires annual reporting concerning the actions that they are taking to meet their waste load allocations. MPCA staff are in the process of developing a reporting form with associated instructions and guidance that will streamline the reporting process for these communities. At this time, MPCA staff has completed the development of the Minimal Impact Design Standards, commonly referred to as MIDS. MIDS was developed as part of a three-year effort between the MPCA and stakeholder groups to develop statewide permanent treatment goals for new development and redevelopment projects. The main component of MIDS includes technically based performance goals that will protect surface water resources, ordinance guidance that can be utilized by communities to help them implement the MIDS performance goals, and a credit calculator that can be used to quantify the amount of stormwater treatment achieved for a number of structural treatment BMPs. Any of these components could be used by permittees to help them meet the post-construction stormwater treatment requirements of the MS4 permit. To develop a network to support the use of the MIDS calculator, the MPCA held two workshops on the calculator during the fall and early winter of 2013 and trained 56 water quality professionals. As part of this training, these individuals, referred to as super users, have agreed to be a resource for others that may have questions concerning how to use the calculator. The Minnesota Stormwater Manual provides a comprehensive resource for the regulated community to utilize regarding design, evaluation, and implementation of stormwater treatment BMPs. To improve and upgrade the manual, MPCA staff has converted it to a web-based Wikipedia-style format. This new format provides search capabilities and the ability to link to other resource documents, making it a much more useful tool for users. Currently, MPCA staff are in the process of updating the manual with BMP credit and design information that has been developed through the MIDS project and are linking the manual to other stormwater-related information. To introduce the new manual format to users, this past spring, MPCA staff held a series of 5 workshops across the state. Staff from the MS4 regulated community were invited to this training, and a total of 144 individuals attended one of the 5 workshops. The stormwater manual is being used. In the past 16 months since the format conversion was completed, this manual has been viewed 1.5 million times. Within the past few weeks, the viewing rate has increased. The manual is currently averaging about 4,000 hits per day. Currently, the MPCA and the Minnesota Erosion Control Association are partnering on a series of 5 MS4 workshops to be held at locations around the state, the first of which will be held later this summer. These workshops will provide regulated communities with information concerning how they can comply with the MS4 permit. Presenters at these workshops will largely be staff from regulated communities. During our upcoming audits, MPCA staff intend to focus on technical assistance and addressing questions that which communities may have concerning the reissued permit. Finally, the Minnesota Cities Stormwater Coalition has approached the MPCA, indicating they intend to create MS4-related guidance for their member cities. MCSC has requested the MPCA staff review their guidance for conformance with the MS4 permit. We are committed to review all guidance submitted to us by MCSC. In summary, our repermitting effort was a success. Our 90-day average for reissuing permit coverage is well below the permitting goal of 150 days. I believe some of the main reasons for our success include the planning and staff resources that went into developing the application forms and workshops, which led to a better understanding by permittees concerning what was needed to complete their applications. Significant time savings and efficiencies were also achieved with our electronic application review process. Finally, credit must also be given to our permittees based on the quality of their applications and their timely response to MPCA staff comments. At least a dozen stormwater section staff were directly involved in either the repermitting effort or the development of guidance and resources. With the guidance and resources developed, the stormwater section staff have provided permittees with a significant set of tools to help them complete their stormwater program updates. MPCA staff look forward to continued success as we continue to work with and assist our permittees. Mr. Chairman and members of the board, on behalf of the solid waste section staff, I would like to thank you for this opportunity to give you this update regarding our program. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. And just appreciate the update for the board members, because I recall the board discussion at the meeting where we were aiming for something that was highly interactive with the regulated community. It sounds like we were able to achieve that. Thank you very much. Questions, board members? Ms. Hang, any from you?
None at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ibarra, any questions for the presenters?
I have none. Thank you.
Thank you. Others on the board? Dr. Drager.
So as I recall in the discussion, and the input from the regulated community was what was going to be the cost of implementing this across the state. I know we're not even a year into the implementation yet, but are we getting any cost estimates versus what we had predicted from the MPCA side in terms of the regulated community?
Mr. Fox.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I have not heard any feedback from any of our permittees regarding specific costs or difficulties in filling out their application to this point. Most of our permittees will have until next spring to fully implement the components of the MS4 permit.
Thank you. I noted on one of your slides that we're working on sort of the process of preparing for audits, and would the cost of implementing be something that comes up during the audit discussion, either a self-audit or an audit by our staff?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we most certainly could include that as part of our questions that we and issues that we raise at audits.
That might be a good, helpful feedback for us to get just as we work our way around the state and we talk with different regulated parties and how the implementation costs are being borne in their community, what the total is, because that would be helpful information. Thank you. Any other questions? Dr. Sampson.
Thank you for the update. I had a question about the number of hits on the guidance there. Do we have any information about why? I mean, 4,000 hits a day is impressive, but It could be for a variety of reasons. It could be because people are finding it so useful they're going to it, or it could be because they're having a hard time finding what they need, so they have to go multiple times to try to find the item they need. Do we have any information about what's driving that many hits?
Mr. Fox?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, it's my understanding all we record is when the website is accessed. We don't have information that gets deeper into where they're going or why they're accessing the site.
Again, I might suggest that as part of our audit, that would be a useful question, is just the feedback on the usefulness of the resource and whether it's a positive or a negative or some of both. So we get the feedback. It's good. Dr. Foley.
Yeah, as you're getting questions from the regulated community and our responses to those, are they made available to in some format for others who may have the same question to see the same answer that we give to one regulated party? And two, are we cataloging the kinds of questions and issues that they're having out there so that we can disseminate that to the regulated community about what's going on? And I guess I'd like to at some point hear back on what are those issues relative to those rules.
Mr. Fox.
Mr. Chairman, members of board, we routinely, when we're doing our workshops, well, we always take evaluations and feedback on what issues are coming up. Most of those issues relate to the information we present at that particular workshop. We have in the past discussed the idea of developing frequently asked questions and posting information like that on our website. We can pursue the utility of doing that. If we are hearing questions over and over that are the same questions, that may be a very useful way to disseminate that information.
And Mr. Fox, you might well, we talk about guidance documents. I assume in the guidance documents we actually are responding to sort of the current issues that people are identifying and how to address construction stormwater site standards, for example, the specific things you raised where we develop guidance in response to issues that come forward. I assume that's what we're using some of that guidance to do.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, yes. The items that I brought to you today on outreach are things that we have done recently that directly address the new requirements of the reissued permit. We have a lot of other guidance on our website. But yes, we try to be current with the guidance we're providing and responsive to issues that we hear. And when we hear an issue that we think the whole MS4 regulated community needs to hear about, we try to put that in some form so that we can get that information out.
Thank you. Dr. Foley.
Yeah, can you speak on that wiki format that you put in place? Is that something that we're using across the MPCA's databases, or is this unique to this program? And if it is unique, are we learning that as people utilize that format, it's really helpful for searching and getting into the detail, that maybe that's a generalized format we should be using? If we're not.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we have found the Wikipedia-style format, which basically is a search engine. Instead of the manual having pages, it now you search on categories or you search on a specific item. We found it to be highly useful, and we've gotten a lot of positive feedback from our permittees and other stormwater professionals. And I think our manual was the first to use this format here at the agency. But our indications are it's highly successful, and it could have other applications.
And Dr. Foley, we like the idea of broadening its use. Yeah. Dr. Drager.
Just kind of getting back to that feedback mechanism, which I think we're kind of referring to as the audit. I like that idea of including how useful our resources are to the regulated community. It would also be interest, as we said, to calculate what is the cost of implementing these rules. And along those lines, what is the environmental impact, if possible, the environmental impact per dollar invested? Because I would be curious to see how those change in practices that the new regulations actually have some environmental impact on the other side. So those are just some ideas of if we're going to do an audit for the regulated community to get both their somewhat it's an opinion on the impact of the environment based on those changes of practice. My second comment is just it's kind of for the board in general, is that when we have an opportunity to reflect back on this was a big decision that this board made, it was covered in the news and it was a lot of deliberation among this board, it's very nice to hear the agency's perspective on how the rollout of these rules have been over the past year. But if there was enough time in advance of this board meeting, it would have been helpful to have another presentation by some representative of the regulated community as well, so that we could have had a balanced perspective both from the board point of view and from the regulated community point of view on how these regulations actually have rolled out. I mean, even if it's a time-bounded thing, you know, 15 minutes for staff, 15 minutes for regulated community, just so that we could get a full perspective on what actually occurred as a result of our decision on that item.
Thank you. We'll take that advice, Dr. Drager. Appreciate that. One other thing I'd say, Dr. Foley, just before you jump back in on the feedback we've been getting nationally, we do hear significant positive comments from the EPA and from other states. So my guess is that some of those hits are coming from outside Minnesota, of folks who are trying to look to that format or the information there and develop their own programs in other places around the country. Because we get a lot of favorable remarks from the EPA, and they speak pretty highly of it. But in the spirit of self-deprecation, we'll try not to say more. Dr. Foley.
Well, just a corollary to this is, as opposed to rules, with the magnitude of some of the storm events that we've had in the state this year, how well has the actual systems that are in place performed? Do you have any assessment relative to the MS4s that have been put into place?
Mr. Schmidt.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, only anecdotally, you know, as I'm sure you've heard, we've had difficulty with overloads on our wastewater treatment systems, and I think it's safe to say that a lot of our storm sewer systems have been similarly burdened. I mean, this is just a challenge we face with climate change and more frequent and intense storm events. And I know that there are plans afoot, you know, nationwide for, you know, reexamination of engineering standards for building sewer systems and things like that. So I think it's just one of those situations where, you know, the issues we faced with the weather are ubiquitous, and they've, you know, they've hurt us in wastewater treatment, and they're hurting us in stormwater as well.
And just I'll comment on that too, Dr. Foley and Mr. Schmidt. I think what you hear initially after major flood events is you hear where the failures occurred. You hear the significant problems, but it's rare that you get sort of notified of the successes. So if there is some infrastructure out there, some municipal storm sewer infrastructure that had a significant event that did not challenge their overall design or community's resilience, we'll ask for that information. But it's not the more normal is you're going to hear the negative first. And if there are positives out there, we can certainly look for that and try to illustrate the point by, I think you're asking a really important question about resilience, not about, you know, the sort of the absolute pro-con environmental impact. But when you look at the long term, when we look at these systems, how they're designed to be to function for a very wide variety of storm events over a long period of time, that's where we're really going to learn better how effective these systems are. Because I can think of things that I told people to do 30 years ago that I'm embarrassed to talk about now. The science and technology of stormwater management has changed dramatically. And I would love to hear the same thing. I'd like to know where they function well. That would be really interesting. Dr. Foley.
Yeah, well, it's right along the same lines. Is there a forum for, I don't know, where the regulated communities where they discuss the strengths and weaknesses of what they've already invested in and what's happened and what worked and what didn't, that comes back to us, because it's easy for us to create rules. I don't mean that rulemaking is easy, but making the rules and almost mandates the engineering, and then we wait and see just whether we guessed right or we thought right, et cetera. I'd like to get some feedback to the board as to the utility and functionality of what's happened with MS-4s, because it's such a big deal. I remember when they were actually involved in the construction and the separation, both in South St. Paul, St. Paul, and Minneapolis. I mean, that's, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of construction based upon rules that were put in place, based upon engineering and thinking that how well did it work? And going forward, then, it allows us to, with the next iteration of rules, to improve it, because that's really what it's all about. Maintaining water quality and not having the runoff that we as humans create in our spaces that we live in. So if there's some information or some time in the future where we can get some feedback to really understand that functionality, I would appreciate that.
Thank you, Dr. Foley. And I see the Municipal Stormwater Coalition folks are in the back of the room, and we'll work with you on that. That would be a good presentation for the board to hear in the future. Any further questions from board members? Hearing none, thank you, Mr. Schmidt, Mr. Fox, for your presentation. Let's move on to our next information item, water quality communication customer research and the final findings. And we're going to have a presentation by Glenn Scuda and Corey Rood-Young of our staff. Board members, I also want to let you know that Bob Tammen has asked to be heard on this matter. And Bob, I'm going to give you 2 minutes at the end of this presentation to come forward and address the board on the subject.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome to the board. Please introduce yourselves and begin your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'm Glenn Scuda. I'm the Surface Water Monitoring Manager in our Environmental Assessment and Outcomes Division here at the PCA. And with me,
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, my name is Corey Rood-Young, and I'm in the Communications and Outreach section here at the MPCA.
So I'll be doing the presentation this morning, and then when we're through, I'll be happy to take questions for both Corey and I. This project was done as a kind of cooperative effort between the program staff and the communications staff. And if you recall, about a little over half a year ago, we came to you for your information and for your help in conducting a customer research project on our water quality communications. And so today we're here to share some of the findings from the project. We're still digesting a lot of the data and information we got. It's kind of a gold mine of a lot of good information, but we want to at least share some of the overall high-level findings with you today. So objective of the project really was to improve the PCA's understanding of how we can best provide information on water quality, the condition of our lakes and rivers to the public, not focusing at all on the more technical partners and experts that we have, other resource managers. We have a lot of connection and communication with them. That's a whole nother story, but this was really about focusing on figuring out if we're getting the information out to the general public the way we should be. So we worked with Minnesota Management and Budgets Management Analysis and Development folks as our primary contractor to conduct this research. And along the way, we also were able to utilize the online community that the Minnesota Department of Transportation has as sort of a check on our work and to gather additional information, which was very helpful. And really, the goals of the project were to try to figure out, you know, what sectors of the general public out there are maybe our more interested public that really care about these issues and want to hear about the condition of the waters of the state. So who they are, what are they most interested in hearing about, and then how do they actually want to receive that information? And then there was kind of a sub-part of the project of working with the media a little bit to figure out how the media and the PCA can sort of work best together, how they affect each other in our communications. So the project was done in – oh, I'm sorry. I didn't have that slide printed out here. To back up a little bit more for the purpose of why do we do this project in the first place, we have a responsibility from the Clean Water Act and the Clean Water Legacy Act to report out on the condition of the waters of our state. We do that in very technical ways, but we also have responsibility to do that in a less technical way to the public. Especially now as we're generating more and more data, more and more information from the resources now available to us through the Clean Water Fund from the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment, it's just that much more important for us to know that we're communicating well and on the right things. So we want to ensure that we're communicating what the public wants to know. It's literally, you know, we could tell people a million things, but they probably don't want to know a million things. So we want to ask them of all the things we could tell you, what do you really need to know and want to know? And rather than just assume, which you have to do a certain amount of, but we want to take the opportunity to actually go out and ask the public, what do you want to know? So, as I said, the project was done in three phases. And the first was identifying who is that interested public. And so we started, our contractors started with doing interviews of PCA staff and with partner organizations to help identify who those potentially more interested general public are. And then interviews and meetings with the PCA Water partner resource managers were conducted and received input from them on who that public is and then their take on how communication with the public is best done. And then we reached out through those organizations to their members or their partners in phase two, which was the actual surveying then of the public. And through management analysis folks, through the identified organizations that you helped identify, our partner resource managers helped identify. They actually sent out the surveys on our behalf because there was always a concern when you're surveying that if a survey comes from the PCA, sometimes people might be a little less likely to respond because they don't know us as well as their association or the people they're most affiliated with, or if they've got a concern about any sort of regulatory aspect of this. So the partners that you and other organizations helped identify actually sent the survey out for us, and then people took the survey online that went directly to management analysis, did not come through us at all. And so we don't have a percent response rate on this because we don't know with the multiple organizations we sent through exactly how many people that would be or for sure exactly how many respondents came from whichever organization, but we do know that we had close to 1,000 people that did respond, which is a good number. And this is, again, the more interested public identified through those organizations. We then did the survey also through the online community at the Minnesota Department of Transportation called MnDOT Talk, and that is a group that they use to regularly share information with the public and get the public's information on mostly transportation projects, but they, like in this case, also use this group to survey the general public about other issues of interest. And so this group really represents, it's put together to represent really the public as a whole. There's an organization MnDOT contracts with that kind of finds the people and creates this community that members change out over time, that type of thing, but it's meant to be a nice cross-section of the true general public. So we're able to compare through the two surveys that were done, the more interested public we identified with the general public. And the MnDOT online community is 450 members. They had 280 people that did respond to this particular survey, which they felt was a very good response rate for what they typically see. And then the third phase of the project was, again, reaching out a little bit to the media to get their opinions on PCA's current communications, how we could be communicating better in the future. We did get a pretty light response from the media, partially because they had some concerns about wanting to maintain some kind of objectivity or a little bit of distance from the people that they cover, which is understandable. And then some were just busy. We heard from numerous folks after the fact saying, oh, I really wanted to take that survey, but didn't have the time. We tried to accommodate as best we could, but we had a schedule to meet as well. And there were still, even though it was light response, some interesting findings that we'll share. So to the findings, and again, can't tell you all the gory details, but we'll try to cover some of the key higher-level findings. One of the questions that was asked was, we gave people 16 choices, including other, and I don't have an opinion, but 16 choices altogether of what are you most interested in hearing about when it comes to, what's the condition of the lakes and rivers in Minnesota? And through the management analysis survey that went out, the five areas that garnered the most interest were the cleanliness of our lakes and rivers related to drinking water, to the consumption of fish, to swimming, overall ecological integrity, and also the impact of agriculture on water quality. We asked people to kind of look at this from different lenses to see if that would change how they do look at these issues at all, and also to see if there was a way that we could kind of cross-check those different lenses. And so we asked people to consider this from the business and economic perspective, from a human health perspective, and an environmental health perspective. And we did see that there were differences when people kind of looked at it through a different lens, that some things were more or less important depending on if they were thinking about it from which one of those three perspectives. So those were the top five that we got through the Management Analysis Division survey. Through the MnDOT survey, when we looked at the human health and environmental health perspective, the box on the left, the exact same top five came out, which was a learning to us of that we did a lot of work to try to identify this more interested public versus the general public. There are some differences between those two, but at least at this higher level, there's also a lot of close similarity between them, that the public, the general public as a whole, had very similar views to what the more interested public we identified had. There were some differences when people were looking at water issues from a business or economic perspective. There were some of the same issues that were identified as high priority, but there were some others such as mining and aesthetics and urban land use that also popped up when people looked at it from a business perspective. What's real interesting here, you look at the box on the left, the top four things that people chose out of the 16 things they could have chosen really do reflect what the Clean Water Act refers to as the beneficial uses on which the Clean Water Act is based. So the top four choices that were selected there really correspond very closely to the aquatic consumption use of the Clean Water Act, the drinking water use, the aquatic recreation use, and the aquatic life use. And this is really, these are the underpinnings of the Clean Water Act, which water quality standards are based upon, and then rules and permits and everything flows from these foundational things. So it's kind of neat to see that the way the Clean Water Act is structured really reflects what the public actually does care about, what they found to be the most important things that they want to hear about. Some of the findings, this isn't everything again, but again, just to give you a little flavor, we were able to do some regional slicing and dicing of the data. The management analysis survey was done based on the PCA regions of the state, so we have 5 or 6 regions that we can identify where people have stronger interests in one thing over another. Don't have it on this slide, but the MnDOT survey was able to do a split out between urban and rural, at least, so we can look at those things. So in terms of regional interests, you see here some examples are in the northeast part of the state. Cleanliness of lakes and rivers for drinking water and impacts of mining were strongest issues there. Southwest was strong on fishing, as well as impact of agriculture. and the cleanliness of water for swimming as an interest issue. North central part of the state, swimming and lakeshore use impacts on water quality, and southeast Minnesota with a strong interest in the impact of agriculture on water quality as well. So we're going to be working with our data desk folks to be doing more slices and analyses of the data. And this is key, I think, for our communications folks, as they'll be developing a communications plan out of this research that we'll be able to, you know, look at how can we regionalize our messages, customize our messages to different parts of the state based on what people are most interested in. There's certain things we have to tell everybody, but if we can tell the stories, give the information related to particular issues that folks are interested in, I think that increases the likelihood that our messages will be received. People will pay attention to them. This was from the Management Analysis Survey. This was an open-ended question where people kind of didn't have to just check a box or give a multiple choice answer, but actually fill in something. And then the contractor kind of took those responses and themed them. And you see the top three here, what people want to hear most about when it comes to the condition of our lakes and rivers. They want to know what's the status and trends of our waters, what's being done, and preservation and improvement efforts. Those are both, I think, pretty closely related. Those are the key things people talked about when they were asked that question. And this was answered by 69% of that, about 950 respondents. So again, a lot of people did respond to this question. Some folks addressed more than one issue in their response. So just to mention, if you haven't seen yet, we do have a new web page or set of web pages called How's the Water that you can access directly from the PCA homepage. It's one of the options on the banner that rotates, where we did try to provide exactly that kind of information on what's status and trends of the lakes, the rivers, the wetlands, groundwater in the state, on a somewhat regionalized basis, splitting the state into three general regions, and also information on what is being done, what can people do to help protect and improve their water resources. So we're kind of on the right track with that, I think, based on what we heard from our responses. From the MnDOT survey, again, kind of reinforcing some of the assumptions we had or what we kind of thought based on the passage of the legacy amendment and such, that they were asking the public how important to you is the condition of lakes and rivers in Minnesota, between very and somewhat important. That's 98% of the people. 72% said very important. So that corresponds with the support of the amendment and Clean Water Fund. But when they asked people, how knowledgeable do you feel about the condition of lakes and rivers in the state, only 2% said, I feel very knowledgeable. 55% said somewhat, and actually 42% said not at all knowledgeable. So there is definitely some room for, so to speak, improvement there, or there's a lot of folks that don't feel like they know what's going on with our lakes and rivers. We have an opportunity here to give people information. It's clearly important to them, but a lot of folks, not quite half, are feeling a little bit in the dark about this. We also asked about, well, how do you want to receive the information so we can work on that? And who do you want to receive it from? PCA was identified, in parts of the survey, so it may have impacted a little bit the numbers here, but it was good to see that the PCA was identified by a lot of people as a source that they do want to receive this information from. The news media, of course, still being a very strong source, as well as our partner agencies at a local and state level, NGOs, educational associations, too. There's a lot of information here from the MnDOT folks, as well as 98% saying that quality of the lakes and rivers is very important to them. 95% of the residents said they're interested in receiving information on the condition of our lakes and rivers. Frequency quarterly popped out as the highest choice there at 37%, so they want to receive information quarterly, 27% monthly. So not daily, but, you know, some pretty good frequency that they'd like to receive it. Again, they also saw that people have a pretty strong reliance on TV and newspaper and radio in that order. And then when they receive electronic information, it's a little bit of a surprise where people say they're getting their electronic information mainly from laptop and desktop computers, followed by tablets, followed by smartphones. And though that we know that's changing and smartphones and mobile devices are becoming more and more popular, it's kind of a good reminder to us that not everybody is there yet. And so though we're going to continue to pursue that and do that, we also have to recognize there's a lot of people that are still using somewhat, you know, older, formerly common electronic technology as well. And this talks about overall how do you frequently receive information about the issues you identified. And again, it's showing that, to me, surprisingly, a pretty large percentage of the people say paper newspaper is still a very strong source for them, followed by television. And then from there it goes on to radio and electronic sources as well. This this is from the MAD survey, similar findings to the MnDOT survey, that desktop and laptop computers are still the largest percentage of the way people get their electronic information, and mobile phones and tablets much less at this point in time. Specific to MPCA communications, how are people currently getting information from us? A lot of folks are getting email updates, electronic newsletters, and using the MPCA website quite a bit. So people are getting information from us, particularly among the interested community. We did see from the MnDOT survey that the more general public had much less connection or contact from the MPCA in terms of receiving information. Briefly on the media phase three research part of this project, we reached out to 35 media reps. We only got response from six for the reasons that I identified. They see their audience as a more general public, but they do also see that their audience is highly interested in water issues, which was played out in our survey as well. In terms of audience interests, what we heard from those that responded, they identified virtually the same issues that did come out in our survey in terms of drinking water issues, ecological integrity, the impact of agriculture, and the cleanliness of water for fishing and aesthetics. So it does seem that from that limited sample of media representatives, they've got a pulse on what folks indicated they are interested in through our surveying. And then in terms of MPCA communications, we asked the media reps to rank how well we're doing on form and format and timeliness, newsworthiness, et cetera. Doing pretty well in their eyes in terms of the form and format of information they are getting from us, pretty good with the timeliness and thoroughness. Part of the challenge we have as an agency is that our news is not always as newsy as everything else going on in the world, maybe not shocking, but that is a struggle for us, is that we have to compete with a lot of things, and the media doesn't always see what we have to offer as being all that newsworthy or interesting, depending on what might be going on in the rest of the world and people's daily lives. So the overall recommendations from management analysis is that, you know, this is all about developing a communications plan. So they're saying, you know, select what your key messages are. And again, that's what this survey was all about, was to help us know what are the key messages, key issues people are very interested in. Take that and develop that communication strategy. That's the next step that we'll be going into over the next several months, particularly our communications folks, focusing on those key messages, customizing with the context, the lenses that the survey shows us, and on a regional basis to the extent possible, and then based on what people said in terms of how they want to receive the information, keeping that in mind, knowing that will change over time as technology changes, what the best delivery mechanisms are. I think numbers 3 and 4 are really key here to keep in mind as we develop this communication plan. We heard this from our local partners pretty strongly when they were interviewed, which was to, beyond as we put the news, the information out on our own using social media, press releases, et cetera, but also to really work with partner organizations to develop kind of communication networks so that we can get information out through them. Similar to how we did the survey through those organizations, getting information to people through those organizations is something that we probably need to exploit. And we heard from a lot of those organizations that they want to help play that role for us of being that kind of conduit. One anecdote on that was a Metro Watershed Management organization talked about how they put a ton of effort into communicating what they need to within their very small jurisdiction. So, you know, in our small jurisdiction, we've got 36 different languages that are spoken, and we've got cultural differences to how communication is supposed to flow, that sometimes it really needs to come through elders in the community versus just coming out of nowhere through the media. And that goes with number 4 here, which is part of the way to expand our communications with underrepresented groups is to work through those types of partners that are in a position to do the communication in some ways better than we're able to. A lot of this is underway through environmental justice efforts here at the PCA already, but this kind of reinforces that and is something that we're going to need to build on as we develop this communications plan. And then we have a desire to measure results over time, particularly on the, will we see an increase in understanding of water quality conditions over time among the public? It's not going to happen overnight, but over time, will we be able to help raise that level? Because people say they're interested and they want to know, but as we saw, they also feel they're in the dark. So we're exploring the use of MnDOT Talk as a tool to be able to do that. We'll also be looking at other potential options and means to make that happen. So right now, next steps are communications team. This is hot off the press. They haven't had a chance to really look at this very much at this point, but we'll be doing communications planning in a regionalized way as appropriate over the coming months. Starting here with the Citizens Board sharing this morning, we'll be sharing it back with the groups that we worked with. We already have sent some of this information back through MnDOT Talk. And you may have seen this morning there was a very nice article that the Star and Tribune did on this project. Corey and I had an interview with a reporter from the Star and Trib yesterday afternoon who did a really nice job of encapsulating what we were doing and why, and that's going to help spread the word a little bit too. So very happy with the work we were able to accomplish in a pretty short period of time. Really want to thank our partners at MAD, Management Analysis folks, also at MnDOT for letting us use their online community, and then also all the partner groups that are identified in the report, the full report in the appendix. We have a listing of the groups that we worked with to get the surveys done and gather this information, and we're looking forward to the next step of working with communications on developing the communications plan based on this from here. So with that, Corey and I are happy to hear what you have to say and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Scuda. And just board members, I'm looking at the online version of the STRIB right now, and it's a good, it is pretty thorough review of the project. So that's wonderful that they took an interest in doing that. I appreciate your getting the word out. I wanted to find out what questions board members have, and I'll give you those of you on the phone a break and start in the room first. So any questions from board members here in the room? Dr. Foley.
You know, I really appreciate this presentation because it's when we as an agency, you know, as opposed to authoritarian governments that have ministries of information and seems to be only a one-way flow of information, learning about how the public learns about how government works and how government's open is very important, and particularly on a subject related to water, which is essential for our own life. So I appreciate what we're learning here and how we're piggybacking on how other state agencies communicate with regulated and just the general public is very important. Companies spend millions of dollars to figure out how they're going to communicate and get information back from their customers. And so this has been very informative, and I think we can take this learning and the learning of the previous communication to us on using wiki formats and things that people utilize. So this has been very helpful to me to see the work that's been done, and I commend you for it. I'm interested also, do you have some information on the age distribution and whether there's differences in what's important to, say, an 18-year-old or a 20-year-old versus an old guy like me who generally doesn't do a lot of swimming in lakes anymore, but a lot of other people do. So do we have any distribution on what's important based on age?
Ms. Rude Young.
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, we, like Glenn had said, this is literally hot off the presses, and that is something that we're sending to our data services to slice and dice a little bit more of the demographic information that was pulled. I think Glenn is checking right now to see if age was even in there. And if it is, those are things that we're hoping to be able to break down even further. Just like we had mentioned, the regional as well. We know where people came from different parts of the state, and as well, where they do they live on a lake? Are they a landowner? Are they a business owner? And break it down a little bit more that way, so we can be very tailored and strategic. So if age is in there, which I don't think it is, we won't be able to look at it that way, but there are other lenses that we can look through.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions from board members in the room? Let's go to the phone. Ms. Hang, any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner, and thank you, Mr. Scudder, and your team for this really proactive project. I had two questions, and the first one really piggybacks on what Dr. Foley was asking. I'm also interested whether any demographic information about the respondents was collected. I'm especially really surprised about the response regarding the newspapers, because I actually think younger constituencies now get most of their news either from Facebook or Twitter, which I don't really understand, but I think they do. So it would be interesting to have the respondents to have their demographics and then correlate that with responses to see, you know, if we can do multiple prong communication strategies, which I'm assuming we probably will, to really to meet those audiences. So that was my first question. And then my second question was, I was just wondering if the survey was translated. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Hang. To the Mr. Scooter or Ms. Rude Young.
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, to the demographic info, I think we just sort of touched on that. But when, like you had just mentioned, the newspapers, what we found was that was regional. It was an outstate where the paper newspapers are still a prevalent source for getting your news information, which from a communications person isn't that surprising. We know that hometown newspapers are a very important source of information. So that's one of the things we are going to look at is regionally, where do they want to get their information from? So maybe something we do here in the metro is different than we're going to do in the Duluth area, let's say. As for the second part of the question, the translation, no, we have not had this translated. However, I would say we are not opposed to that if there is some other different ways we can get this out to different communities.
Ms. Hang, could I ask you, are you interested in trying to distribute the results to a community that would require translation?
Well, my question is actually more about the implementation of the survey, and this really goes back to the first question. I just want to make sure that the information that we're getting is really representative of all the different constituency groups that we want to work on.
Understood.
And I think that there are some populations in our community that are very vulnerable, and they're most susceptible to any kind of changes in water quality.
but because they may not be able to access information, then we're not getting that feedback. And so I know that this project is supposed to be proactive, and I just hope that in that proactive thinking, we're also thinking about some of these other populations that that we want to, you know, whether we're currently communicating with them or in the future, we want to do a better job of communicating with them.
Thank you. That's great feedback. Mr. Ibarra, any questions or comments?
No, I was just curious about the demographic information, and that question's already been answered. So no further questions. Thank you.
Very good. Seeing no further questions, Dr. Foley.
So are you going to be working on your top four issues or coming up with a plan? Are you going to do all 16? doesn't seem to be a swallowable bite. So what's your plan relative to that feedback that you have so far?
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, the next steps are for, like we have mentioned earlier, to slice and dice it a little bit more with our own data services team and then meet with the communications section as a whole and really start taking a look at what we found with these results and how we can be more targeted and strategic and looking at those, probably the top five that came up. Some of them were surprising. I mean, having agriculture make it into the top five is something we maybe want to take a look at. It was also, like Glenn had mentioned, very good to see that it reinforces with the Clean Water Act. So really making sure we're hitting home on those priorities. So I think more is definitely to come as we meet with more groups about this.
So the planning is just about to start, really. So we'll be working that over the next several months.
So just for the staff to note, when the plan is ready or being developed and not quite ready, but we have a sense of it, let's bring it back to the board for some clarification. And perhaps we could even do some outreach to the public. And now that we've got such great technological capabilities, perhaps we'll have an interactive conversation about it. Try some really scary stuff. Very good. Thank you. Board members, so that concludes our second information item. Oh, Mr. Tammann, I apologize. Bob Tammann, I agreed to give you a couple minutes to come address the subject before the board. Mr. Tammann resides in Sudan, and I appreciate the fact that you and your wife make frequent trips down to the city to be heard. So, Mr. Tammann, if you would please come forward and test and give us your comments on this subject. Welcome to the board.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I appreciate your indulgence. I'm Bob Tammann from Sudan, Minnesota. In my younger days, I worked in several of the mines. And when I saw this subject on the agenda, it immediately brought back some memories. And I'm reading through the number one on the list here, that the challenges to identify sectors of the public in Minnesota who are most interested in receiving technical and non-technical information. And I would like the agency to give some thought to how do we communicate with the people that are least interested in technical information science, because we have a problem in Minnesota, and I say that because my wife Pat and I live within a mile of Lake Vermilion. And we have some problems with Lake Vermilion, and I know the agency is dealing with them, but the problems are pretty well acknowledged. I have a document from the Pollution Control Agency, Citizens Lake Monitoring Program. Sulfate concentrations in Lake Vermilion are relatively high in 2008 as compared to other lakes in the Northern Lakes and Forest Ecoregion. We have a little problem. Another draft EIS, MNTAC, and states that MNTAC and the MPCA are concerned about the increasing concentrations of sulfate, chlorides, hardness, and specific conductance of the waters in the basin. And so, as someone who lives up there and is involved in clean water issues, I think we have a serious lack of scientific understanding in our community. And I say this because of a letter that was written to the Timber Jay newspaper. And I'd brought up concerns about MNTAC's leaking tailings pond, and the agency is dealing with that and other issues. And A gentleman in our community wrote a letter to the Timber Jay. Lake Vermilion is not being polluted by the tailing pond. Flat out. And I'm familiar with this gentleman's background. I believe he has a benefit of a university education. And how did he miss the information that's readily available if you go looking? And, of course, he does come with a point of view. He closes his letter by saying that the warped thinking of Bob Tamman and the rest of the wacko environ-nuts is sick, sick, sick. So we do see a little, probably it's a little politics, a little culture, but, you know, I read to you from the documents that your agency prepared. We have a little problem in Lake Vermilion, and we have quite a few people that want to flat out deny that there's any problem whatsoever. And so when we do our communication thing, and I know it's a heck of a challenge in a state as large as Minnesota to reach every citizen, but I think that's one of the things about our state. The more citizen involvement, probably the better if we can get informed citizens. And so I thank you today for allowing a citizen to come and have his 2 minutes. Thank you.
Mr. Tamman, you're a role model for citizen involvement. Thank you very much. Board members, we have that concludes our information item. We're going to move on to the decision item. I wanted to ask if folks need a short break. I'm seeing nods. Let's take a 10-minute break. Let's call the meeting back to order. And board members, while we were away at break, you got a handout of the copy of today's Star Tribune article by Samantha Schmidt that talks about the presentation we just had. So that's for your information. Also want to remind everyone that we have board members on the phone today, and so we are doing quite well so far. Everyone's using their microphones and being heard. We appreciate that. A reminder, if anyone is desiring to be heard on the decision item today, please fill out a green slip and bring that forward to the board secretary seated to my left, and we will take your interest in mind and decide what order and who will be heard. The decision item before us today is a review, a request for review and a petition for stay and reconsideration of the adoption of the amendments that were passed last month for eutrophication of river streams, the Mississippi River pools, and Lake Pepin, and the revision of the turbidity standard to a standard of total suspended solids and other minor and clarifying corrections to the rules. Today, board members, in the presentation, what we're going to do is we're going to get a presentation from Ms. Olson, the board attorney, who will help us understand sort of the legal standard of review and the subject that we're going to be debating, just from a what is the board's job. We haven't had one of these in quite some time, and let's make sure we have the legal information before us. Then I'm going to ask Ms. Elizabeth Wafel on behalf of MESRB to speak to the matter, and then other testifiers who I admit for testimony will follow Ms. Wafel, and then we'll have the staff respond before the board asks questions. So that's sort of the order that we'll have the presentations, and obviously when the staff are up at the end is when we would ask most of the question, but certainly encourage you to ask clarifying questions for your understanding during earlier presentations. With that, Ms. Olson, please introduce yourself and begin your presentation.
My name is Karen Olson. I'm a Deputy Attorney General and counsel for the board. Thank you, Chairman, board members. As the chairman mentioned to you, there's a petition of a stay of a final decision you made at the last board meeting and also reconsideration of that decision. Rule 7000.07750 allows for someone to petition for a stay. It states that the petition must comply with the requirements of Part 7000.2100 relating to timing, serving of petition, and petition contents. I don't think anyone's here arguing that there hasn't been compliance with that part of the rule. The board's or commissioner's grounds, in your case the board, for granting or denying the petition are the same as the requirements of Part 7000.2100. So again, we go to 7000.2100. It talks about the petition for the stay, the petition contents, and then subpart 3 talks about the grounds for granting or denying a petition. The petition shall be granted upon a showing that there are irregularities in the hearing, errors of law, or newly discovered material issues of fact that could not have been discovered prior to the board's or commissioner's final decision and of such importance as are likely to have altered the outcome of the decision. You'll note that subpart 4 also requires a timing provision, and that is why is it at this board meeting that you're reconsidering and looking at the stay. Just to remind you, I talked about this at the last board meeting, but this is an issue with regard to rulemaking. And the rule 7000.0750 sets forth what you can consider when you're making a decision on rulemaking. And it states the record upon which the board shall make a final decision concerning the adoption, amendment, or appeal of the rule consists of the following. In particular, I just want to draw your attention to Part C. For rules adopted with a public hearing, the documents listed in Part 1400.2220, which is essentially the agency documents that were put into the record, 1400.2230, that would be the comments, if you look at that rule, allowed after the hearing, and 1400.2240, which is the ALJ report. And it goes on, including the report of the administrative law judge and the report of the chief administrative law judge, if any. Then it also talks about written comments submitted to the agency as allowed by Part 7000.0650, subpart 6, and oral statements as allowed by subpart 5. So if we go to those rules, 7000.0650 talks about public participation and board meeting. And I'm going to, or oral presentations, I'm going to direct you to the last part of that rule. You can read the whole subpart. But oral presentations following a rulemaking or contested case hearing must be limited to the record for the matter. Likewise, in subpart 6, it discusses what written materials can be allowed. And part B of that states, for matters for which a rulemaking hearing has been held, written comments must be limited to the record of the rulemaking hearing and must be served on the board at least 5 days before the board meeting, during which the board is scheduled to act on the proposed rules. I just want to remind you that as happened at the last board meeting and at this board meeting, when you're looking at this issue, you can only have written statements and oral comments that relate to the rulemaking record. That's what your decision has to be on, and that's what should be presented in front of you today. And at the same time, I'll ask all the participants to keep that in mind when you're presenting your comments. All the written comments would have already been provided. I talked to you about what the requirements were for the stay, and just want to remind you, too, those who were on the board a year ago, there was a petition for a stay on the MS-4. The MS-4 is the topic you heard earlier today. So this issue has come up before the board before. Not real frequent in my last few years, but it certainly has come up. When you're looking at a stay, it requires a vote of the majority of the board. But when we go into statute 116.02, that states that the agency must not reopen, rescind, or reverse the decision of the agency except upon either the affirmative vote of two-thirds of the agency, which is greater than just a majority, or a finding, again, and this is similar to the same language that was in the stay, that there was an irregularity in a hearing related to the decision, an error of law, or a newly discovered material issue of fact. I also want to remind you, and I noted this at the last board meeting, that Rule Statute 14.19 provides that within 180 days after issuing of the administrative law judge's report or that of the chief administrative law judge, the agency shall submit its notice of adoption, amendment, or repeal to the State Register for publication. If the agency has not submitted its notice to the State Register within 180 days, the rule is automatically withdrawn. This rule, ALJ report, was issued on May 2, 2014. Therefore, the deadline is October 29, 2014. And then last, I also want to point out in Statute 14.16, Subdivision 1, states that after receipt of the administrative law judge's report, if the agency makes any modifications to the rule, it must return the rule, proved as to form by the reviser, to the chief administrative law judge for a review of legality, including the issue of whether the rule, as modified, is substantially different, as determined under Section 14.05, Subdivision 2, from the rule as originally proposed. I just point that out. If you decide to make amendments to the rule, what would have to happen is it would have to go back to the administrative law judge. With that, I'm going to
Dr. Foley has a question. And just before you ask that question, Dr. Foley, can I just confirm, Ms. Hang, are you on the phone?
I am, yes.
Thank you. Mr. Ibarra, are you present?
I am present.
Thank you. Just wanted to make sure that was clear for everyone in the room that we have two board members on the phone still. And a question, Dr. Foley.
Yeah, thank you. Well, with respect to that last statement you had on 14.16, if something is submitted to the chief administrative law judge, how does that affect the clock of the 180 days?
Ms. Olson.
There is a provision that states, I'm not going to be able to find it right at the top of my head, that while the administrative law judge has the rule, that that's not counting against the clock. I'm not 100% certain. I'd have to clarify that that's the case if it's because of modification.
Others on staff, I see Ms. Winters and Ms. Cohen are looking in the language right now. So we'll get a more clarified response to that, assuming they can find that provision in the law. Other questions of clarification for Ms. Olson from board members? Dr. Foley.
Yeah, with respect to 7000.0650, public participation, that part B you referred to.
Which slide, Dr. Foley?
Which slide? I don't know. I'm not going to count.
Public participation, is it subpart 5, oral, or subpart 6?
It's.
I have them up.
It has to do with subpart 6B. The material upon which we can deliberate and make a decision also includes information we received in the oral presentations of the decision-making meeting. So for this purpose, last month's meeting, if things we heard in that they presented orally and the written stuff, both of those are applicable to the discussion and decision we would have today.
Olson.
That chair, board members, Dr. Foley, that is correct, but it has to be limited to the rulemaking hearing. So it's not appropriate to bring information, scientific evidence that wasn't part of the rulemaking hearing.
Thank you. Any questions, Ms. Hang, for Ms. Olson?
None at this time, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you. Mr. Ibarra, any questions for Ms. Olson?
No, Commissioner, I have none at this time.
Thank you. Dr. Sampson.
Toward that end, not bringing things to bear that were not part of the original rulemaking, that were not originally presented. Will you help us stay on track then if we bring something up? I mean, we will make do our utmost to do that, but will you also serve as a check, or is there a process to serve as a check on that for all of us in this process, since it's fairly restrictive according to the law?
Ms. Olson.
Chair and board members, Dr. Carolyn Sampson. I actually was not part of the rulemaking. There are people in the audience. There's a council with the MPCA that was part of the rulemaking, and she will be watching for that, as long as I would expect that MESRB as well will be watching for that. And if there's any questions arise, I can certainly help you answer as to whether or not there's an issue.
And Ms. Olson, as well as Dr. Sampson, I would say that having reviewed the packet and knowing how the staff recommendation has been constructed, I believe we focused on the subject matter that's relevant for the board. So I expect the testimony from our staff that will wrap up the presentation today will make some comments regarding that. So we'll do our best if it is unclear at that point, please feel free to ask at the time that the staff presentation is being made. All right, let's move on. Ms. Wafel, I'm sorry, Ms. Olson.
Could I clarify one more thing?
Yes,
for
please.
Dr. Foley? It is Rule 14.19. My memory served me right, or Statute 14.19. My memory served me right, I just didn't know the statute, that any days used for review by the ALJ do not count. But I do want to direct you back to 14.16 again, because if you follow after the bolded section, if the chief administrative, if the chief administrative law judge determines that the modified rule is substantially different from the rule that was originally proposed, the chief administrative law judge shall advise the agency of actions that will correct the defects. The agency may not adopt the modified rule until the chief administrative law judge determines that the defects have been corrected, or, if applicable, that the agency has satisfied the rule requirements for the adoption of a substantially different rule. So while the timing may not count while it's with the ALJ, it's going to count when it comes back to the agency, and your 180 days is going to continue to run.
Thank you. With that, Ms. Wafel, on behalf of MESRB. Sorry, I can never remember the entire name. It's the Minnesota Environmental Science and Economic Review Board.
Excellent.
Otherwise known as MESRB in abbreviation. Welcome to the board, please. We'll get your PowerPoint slides arranged and introduce yourself.
Great. Thank you.
Please proceed,
okay,
Ms.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and board members, for allowing me to appear today. My name is Elizabeth Wafel. That's W-E-F-E-L, and I'm a senior attorney with the law firm of Flaherty & Hood in St. Paul. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Environmental Science and Economic Review Board, a municipal joint powers board consisting of over 40 cities, public utilities, commissions, and sanitary sewer districts throughout greater Minnesota. With me is David Lane, the environmental and regulatory coordinator with the Rochester Water Reclamation Plant, and MESRB president. He's available for questions if any should arise. I am appearing today on behalf of Steve Nias, MESRB's counsel, who is out of state this week. He sends his regrets for not being able to attend in person. Now to the petition. As explained in our petition for reconsideration, MESRB believes there are a number of clear errors that justify reversing the June 24th hearing decision. I'd like to focus on the three main issues and explain how the staff response confirms the clear error and need for reversal. First, there's simply no information in the record showing any of MESRB's expert positions were found to be an error by an earlier peer review. Second, there are no peer-reviewed treatises or guidance documents in the records actually showing that dissolved oxygen flux or biochemical oxygen demand impair aquatic life, or that BOD is a valid nutrient impairment indicator. And finally, the MPCA staff makes clear that streams without excessive plant growth were not intended to be declared impaired, but the flexibility needed to avoid this result were never adopted into the rule. To my first point, throughout this rulemaking process, MESRB has raised technical objections around three core issues: the use of BOD as a response variable, the use of DO flux as a response variable, and the application of the large river nutrient concentration limits and response criteria to small streams. When the MPCA did not address these issues, MESRB then asked the MPCA to identify where peer review or EPA assessments actually addressed six critical issues raised by MESRB and its experts in its comments. Those are noted in the petition before you. Even in the July 10th response, there's nothing that answers these questions. No one ever agreed that it is appropriate to treat small streams in the same manner as large streams. No one ever said BOD is a valid indicator of nutrient impairment. No one ever said that minor changes in DO flux by themselves will cause aquatic life impairment. And no one ever said that simplified methods are reliable without confirming excessive plant growth or completing a confounding factors assessment. Instead of providing a specific response to these issues, MPA staff has continued to argue that because the standards were independently peer-reviewed, no other valid scientific concerns exist, pointing to a list of studies described as independent reviews, mostly from 2009 and 2010, years before the standards proposal. As a specific response to MESRB's petition, the July 10th response on page 4 claims that the reviews include comments on BOD, DO flux, and small stream responses. The problem is that there's no citation to a single specific page that illustrates the scope of those comments, or more importantly, where one could verify that MESRB's issues with those parameters were reviewed and determined to be unsupported. A request for this type of specific support has been repeatedly made, but we haven't received it. One can only conclude that it does not exist in the record. There is an attempt to gloss over this lack of specificity with the argument that because earlier peer reviewers did not identify MESRB's issues of concerns, then the subsequent issues raised by MESRB are invalid. The staff responses claimed our issues were not significant because earlier reviews had not raised them, not because the reviews had specifically addressed them. And you can see that at attachment page 4, where the MPCA simply observed that neither EPA nor its technical reviewers raised major issues as to the application of BOD or DO flux. Failing to raise an issue plainly is not the same, however, as specifically finding the issue to be unsupported. If the board were to apply that logic, it would mean that if an initial peer review did not address an issue, then that issue should be ignored, even if later analysis confirms that the issue is important. The key EPA stressor response guidance on proper nutrient derivation referenced by MESRB came out in November 2010, after virtually all of the peer reviews being cited by the MPCA were completed. It would not be possible for these documents to address in advance the issues MESRB raised. It is simply improper as a matter of law to suggest that the mere existence of these 3 to 4 year old reviews is a sufficient basis to rebut all subsequently developed scientific comments. Nothing in MPCA's responses provides a reasonable or objective basis to conclude that the earlier general peer reviews somehow addressed the specific issues MESRB raised. A true independent peer review that specifically addresses these issues is necessary and appropriate. Our second point is that the claimed scientific support from other states and other bodies that was discussed at the hearing last time simply is not there. MESRB has repeatedly stated that an independent peer review is needed because the use of BOD and DO flux as response variables is a novel approach, unsupported by any literature evaluation as impairment thresholds, and that the MPCA has never performed a confounding factors analysis, which should have been necessary to adopt this criteria. At the hearing and in the July 10th response, MPCA staff have claimed that using BOD5 and DO flux as water quality standards variables is not unique to Minnesota because Montana and Ohio use these variables, and further, that the EPA has expressed clear support for inclusion of BOD and DO flux as variables. First, the EPA's supposed endorsement of the use of these variables says nothing about whether the approach is scientifically novel. That question is determined by the body of scientific literature on a subject, for which MPCA identified no treatises, guidance documents, or peer-reviewed studies showing DO flux causes fishery impairment or that BOD test is an accepted nutrient impairment indicator. Setting a journal article indicating that measuring BOD may be helpful does not equate with a conclusion that the BOD test standing alone is a reliable indicator. Second, the staff claims regarding the state usage of BOD and DO flux as nutrient impairment criteria are not correct. No state, including Montana or Ohio, has ever adopted these variables as numeric water quality, as proposed by the MPCA. We've thoroughly reviewed the sources cited by the MPCA for these states, and the use of these variables as water quality standards simply isn't there. They haven't been adopted as standards, and they haven't been formally proposed. The characterizations to the board don't reflect this reality. As stated by Montana's guidance on assessing the nutrient impairment for streams, Montana has no standard for ambient BOD in streams, that they recommend using a value of 8 milligrams per liter as a threshold for concern. That very limited use of the BOD test is radically different from the MPCA's intended use of the BOD test. Ohio does not even use BOD as a possible indicator of nutrient impairment. With respect to DO flux, Montana and Ohio use much higher DO flux as an indicator because they're related to minimum DO levels, which are the cause of the impairment MPCA is attempting to use DO flux. Which are the cause of the impairment MPCA is attempting to use DO flux independent of minimum street DO, which is a radically different approach. And this was our point all along. A regulator simply cannot apply DO flux as a determinant of impairment unless the state has information indicating minimum DO is not being achieved. In summary, it is apparent that what the MPCA is doing is unprecedented, unrelated to nutrient impacts, and is missing critical information to ensure that the criteria are not misapplied. These serious factual errors regarding what other states were doing that were used to claim that the approaches were accepted by the scientific community when they clearly were not mandate remand of this proposal. And finally, our third point is that the claimed flexibility that was raised in the hearing and in the response continues to evolve and is simply not there. One of the biggest concerns that MESRB and others have raised, and a number of you have recognized, is that these standards could result in many streams and rivers being declared impaired when they're not, because factors other than excess algae can influence DO flux and BOD readings. At the June 24th hearing, staff tried to reassure board members by stating that they'd address this on a case-by-case basis. Similar assertions were made in the public comment responses. For example, if you were to look at Attachment 6 at Response 10, it said if periphytons are causing excessive DO flux, this would not be identified as an impairment. Also, the MPCA will not measure BOD immediately downstream of a wastewater treatment WWTP outfall where it may be possible to have high TP and high BOD that is not a function of the river's TP. Again, that was in Attachment 1. The problem with these assurances is that the rule language does not contain such qualifiers to ensure proper application of the proposed criteria. In the supporting papers for today's hearing, the MPCA's response has shifted. Flexibility would be gained by allowing permittees to seek a site-specific standard rather than by MPCA ignoring the criteria. These evolving responses indicate that the staff does not intend that waters that do not exhibit excessive plant growth, regardless of the BOD or DO flux readings, to be identified as nutrient impaired. What needs to happen is that the rule must recognize this condition and be formally amended to implement that intended response. In sum, we all recognize the need for water quality standards that address eutrophication and turbidity in place. But as we talked about at the last hearing, these rules will have a significant financial and economic impact on communities across Minnesota. We need to get it done right, even if it means sending things back or taking more time. The MPCA staff response to our request for reconsideration has confirmed, not rebutted, the need for further scientific review regarding this proposed regulatory action. A peer review is needed given the repeated attempts to ignore the key technical issues raised by MESRB and the clear misrepresentation of the available administrative record. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of MESRB's petition and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Wafel. Any questions from board members? Let's start with the phone. Mr. Ibarra, any questions for the testifier?
No questions.
Thank you. Ms. Hang.
No questions at this time, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you. Board members, any questions for Ms. Wafel? None at this time. Thank you, Ms. Wafel. Dr. Foley.
I wonder if you could go over this Montana and Ohio issue again for me.
Okay.
I mean, I know that you, in your footnote 22 on your letter, talk about that. And the level of 7 milligrams per liter issue. And I'd like you to speak to, so if we as a state choose a different number based upon information, that's a number that we choose based upon analysis by our staff, et cetera, is present to us versus what they utilize. So if they're utilizing it, but only at a different level, why are we in error?
Ms. Wafel.
Okay, if I understand your question, I believe you're asking.
First, I'd like you to just talk about Ohio and Montana and their use of it. And then we'll quibble about the number.
Okay. Thank
you. If you notice, I have two microphones so I can speak out of both sides of my mouth.
Excellent. you know, our point with this is again, going back to trying to stay limited to what's in the record and what's happened before us, is that, you know, we've raised all along that we don't believe these two criteria should be used as part of a rule because there's not scientific basis. And so during the course of the discussion, it was raised that by staff that this is a scientifically accepted way of doing things. And Montana and Ohio were pointed to as examples. And so we went back and reviewed the record, and, you know, I'll be honest, we actually talked to them, that they're not using that criteria. And I'll admit I'm not as scientific as John Hall, and but I'm also supposed to be stating what's already on the record. So I think what we can state is that, you know, as was presented at the previous hearing, those are used as indicators of certain things but are not used as standalone criteria in any other rules. And then we don't believe that there's any scientific basis for using them as they're being proposed in the rules. And again, Montana and Ohio had been held up as examples of where that's happening, but they're not actually using it. And Montana, you know, with and I have to look at my own notes, I apologize. With respect to the BOD, Ohio doesn't even have a standard for ambient BOD at all. They don't discuss it. And then Montana basically recommends a certain value as a threshold for concern, which is not the same as using it as a test like Minnesota's proposing. So what we're saying with this is that we've pointed out on a number of occasions there's not the scientific grounding for this, and that we think you can't point to these other states to say that the scientific literature supports it, because it doesn't, because they're not using it in that same way either. And we believe that these tests as being proposed are go beyond what is based in science out there and are not needed and reasonable.
Dr. Foley.
Did I answer your question?
It's getting there.
Okay.
It's helping me to think about it. Well, we have a paper that was presented, and you quoted that mm-hmm. on your page 5, under the middle section, footnote 140, talking about establishing relationships among nutrient concentrations, phytoplankton abundance, and biochemical oxygen demand in Minnesota in 2001. Okay, so that paper. And you say there isn't anything in the literature. Has there not been any response to that paper that is in the literature that basically would constitute a peer review, a scientific peer review?
We haven't seen any specific citations, sorry, that point to, you know, a specific response on that. The, you know, there's been very general comments that there are peer reviews, but I can't point to a page in line that would show a response to that.
Mr. Chairman, sometimes, you know, there's an aphorism that silence is agreement. Mm-hmm. So is there there's nothing in the literature that you've been able to come up with that says people would refute what their paper said, and that also is important.
Ms. Wafel.
Okay, if I understand your question,
well, you told me that you don't know of anything. You're talking about peer review.
Right.
We have a very important paper that was cited as part of the background of this. That's now 13 years ago. And is there no one ever commented or utilized this in any other publication or deliberation? I'm assuming the staff is going to be able to talk to us about the paper and any response and how they utilize it, etc., that may constitute basically an open peer review. I don't know what journal it might have been in and whether that's a peer-reviewed journal. So if it is, then it does have peer review.
Okay. I'm not aware of any.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Just a double check, Mr. Ibarra or Ms. Hang?
No questions from me.
None from me either. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wafel, Mr. Lane, for presenting to the board. Let us move on to Randy Neprash. For the sake of managing our time, Mr. Neprash is going to speak to the question. 3 minutes, please. Thank you. Following Mr. Neprash will be Mr. Nelson, also 3 minutes before the board, and then the staff presentation. Welcome, Mr. Neprash. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Commissioner Stein, members of the board. My name is Randy Neprash. I'm the staff of the Minnesota City Stormwater Coalition. I spoke at the June 24th meeting in support of the MESRB request for independent peer review. And I wanted to speak briefly to two things from that last meeting that may be relevant to your decision today. The first is a very brief characterization of the beginnings of the discussion among the board after all the presentations at last month's meeting. Dr. Foley expressed some interest in seeking additional information, which then led to an immediate discussion about the administrative process, and that in very broad terms, if you were successful in that endeavor, you ran the very real risk of driving the entire administrative process almost back to square one. This was a distressing situation from the outside. You folks, this board, serves an enormously important oversight function and obviously holds final decision-making authority. You come into a process like this very late in the process. And the idea that the administrative process itself impedes the board from being able to acquire additional information that it wants and perhaps feels that it needs to make a good decision seems very distressing. And in very broad terms, I would suggest may indicate that the process is fundamentally flawed, which leads to a much broader discussion and perhaps legislative remedy. It may also be relevant for your decision today about this stay. The other item was a characterization of the goals of, we were speaking in support of seeking the independent peer review. And at one point in the discussion, that was characterized by a board member, this is a very close paraphrase, desire for a different outcome is not sufficient reason to convene another review. This, I believe, was an inaccurate and distressing characterization of our goals in supporting the independent peer review. Strong scientific support for a rule of such consequence it's difficult to underestimate or that's enormously important. From the city perspective, like the agency, we are public entities. As we move ahead with public expenditures, public decisions that flow from the consequences of rules like this, we need to be able to cite the scientific support for such investments and commitments with a strong feeling of authority. That is our reason to seek independent peer review. We honestly do not know whether there will be, we don't know where the peer review will go. We have to provide reasons for the peer review, and hence it sounds as though we expect that there will be a different result. But that's not what drives our interest in having that peer review. We want the solid science, and we need that. And in this case, it was our feeling that that work was flawed and that additional work and the independent peer review was appropriate in order to have the sufficient scientific support. So we would ask you to consider the item today, but also, you know, items like this when we come to the board in light of that characterization rather than this oversimplistic and inaccurate characterization that was presented and discussed at the last board meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Niepresch.
Thank you.
Mr. Nelson. We'll be aiming for 3 minutes as well, Mr. Nelson. Thank you.
Mr. Commissioner and Citizens Board members, thank you for your time. I'm Paul Nelson from Scott County. I have spoken throughout the record both to the Administrative Law Judge and to you before. I speak in support of MESRB's petition and the need for independent peer review. I also feel that many or pretty much all of the questions that I have brought up in the 3 years that I have been involved in this have not been answered. I find that most of the time it refers back to references and documents that are at least 20 years old. We have new information, particularly with respect to the area that I'm talking about in the lower Minnesota River Basin, that is decidedly different than the way it's mapped. And that information is there, and that information has been provided both to you and your staff, and they continue to marginalize it. And that's why I think that has part of the record, and that's why it needs to be addressed. Second thing I'd like to point out in also support of MESRB's thing is that at the last meeting, there were some inconsistencies between the record from what I see and what was said by staff. Ms. Kessler repeatedly said that staff has considered geomorphology. I've looked through the record. I've looked through the documents. I don't find the word anywhere. I don't find any geomorphic assessment done in support of the agency's position. That said, Mr. Niepresch said somewhat what I wanted to close with. I get it. I get that there's a pecking order, that you have the authority to set rules that will in turn cost those in the regulated community some time and some financial resources. And that's appropriate when there is a public benefit to that. We on that side accept that. That's okay. But we have to trust that you use science objectively. I've not seen this in this process. And my trust meter is about at zero. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Let's turn to the staff for your presentation now. And to the extent that you are interested in hearing that, board members, we will look to the staff presentation to respond to comments that have been made, but also to focus us back, but to continue to focus the board on the question before us and the standard of review that we are responsible for today. So, Ms. Lotthammer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. We appreciate the opportunity to respond to the petition before you. My name is Shannon Lotthammer. I'm the Director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division here at the PCA. With me is Katrina Kessler, the manager of the Water Assessment Section within the Outcomes Division. You'll remember Katrina and me from the previous presentation to the board last month. Also with me is Jean Coleman, a PCA staff attorney who's been working with our scientists and rulemaking staff on the river eutrophication and total suspended solids rulemaking. Jean will summarize for the board the MPCA staff's response to the MESR petition. As you'll hear from Jean, the MPCA staff do not agree with the assertions in the petition, and we recommend that the board deny the petition. With that, I'll turn the microphone over to Jean to briefly summarize our response and recommendation, and then I'll have a few comments before closing our presentation.
Thank you. Welcome to the board. Ms. Coleman, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, board members. For the record, my name is Jean Coleman, and I am a staff attorney with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I have worked with MPCA staff throughout the rulemaking procedure and appear today, as Shannon stated, to summarize the staff response to the MESR petition. All of the points that I will make today are in the staff response that each of you received in the mail. As Ms. Olson stated, the petition does not provide any newly discovered material issues of fact, but does assert irregularities in the hearing and errors of law. I will address each of these two assertions in turn. The phrase irregularities in the hearing refers to departures from required procedures or standard practice at either the January 8th rulemaking hearing before the administrative law judge or departures at the June 24th MPCA board hearing. There were no procedural irregularities at either of these hearings. The January rulemaking hearing followed all the procedures required by law, as noted in the administrative law judge's report. The June board meeting followed all procedures required by law. The board meeting was properly noticed, a quorum was present, and all interested persons were given an opportunity to be heard. At its core, the MESR petition asserts that MPCA board members relied on mischaracterizations of the rulemaking record or on information that was not in the rulemaking record when the board voted to adopt the TSS river eutrophication rules at its June meeting. The MPCA staff disagrees with this assertion. The petition, as you will have noted, identifies very specific points in the June board meeting where it is alleged that MPCA staff mischaracterized facts in the record or made a statement that was outside the rulemaking record. Ms. Olson covered the scope of the documents that are in the rulemaking record. And to respond to the petition, MPCA staff first reviewed the webcast from the June board meeting to refresh their memory on what was said. Staff then compared what they said at the meeting to the written rulemaking record. Attachment 2 to the staff response to the petition, which is in your board packet, it is the legal size document, has a chart that compares each of the assertions in the MESR petition where they claim staff mischaracterized or misstated the record. And it shows in detail page numbers and documents where the support for those statements are made by staff are in the rulemaking record. The rulemaking record is very broad in this rulemaking. It's very extensive. And so when you go through attachment 2, you will see references to page numbers, to other documents. We tried not to bring in each of those documents, but to direct you to them in the rulemaking record. Attachment 2 shows that staff statements at the board meeting were accurate statements of what appears in the rulemaking record. The petition is also not the first time MESRB has made comments about the issues that they raised today or at the June board meeting. Messer raised these issues at the rulemaking hearing and in post-hearing comments. The MPCA staff responded to these issues on the rulemaking record. Attachment 1, which is the large document, it has excerpts from the rulemaking record that show MESRB's comments at the rule hearing and their post-hearing comments. It also shows MPCA's staff responses to each of those very detailed comments. In the rulemaking process, the agency is required to respond to comments and demonstrate the rational basis for the proposed rules. The agency is not required to agree with the commenter or answer every issue to the satisfaction of the person making the comment. As you can see in the attachment one, MPCA responded extensively in the rulemaking record to MESRB's comments. I would like to draw your attention to two examples of how our statements to this board at its June meeting were accurate and do reflect the rulemaking record. These examples are taken from page 4 of yet another document, which is the staff response memo that was sent to you 2 weeks ago. So in that 6-page document on page 4, the topic of the scope of peer review is raised. MESRB alleges that MPCA staff mischaracterized the record by stating that peer reviewers were asked to review all response variables, including 5-day biochemical oxygen demand and dissolved oxygen flux. As you can see at the top of page 4 of the MPCA staff response, the rulemaking record contains multiple hearing exhibits and multiple sonar documents that about peer reviews. These references are not merely statements that the peer reviews exist. They are the actual comments from the peer reviewers. And these peer review comments include specific comments on BOD and DO flux. In response to Member Foley's question regarding the 2001 document that we refer to often as a baseline document for these standards, that indeed was published in a peer-reviewed journal, one that you may not be familiar with. The name of that journal is Lake and Reservoir Management. It is published by the North American Lake Management Society. That publication is a peer-reviewed publication, and so the article, as it was published, was peer-reviewed prior to publication. That article has also been cited in additional peer-reviewed publications since it was published. Secondly, on the topic of how the proposed rule would be implemented to prevent non-impaired waters from being listed as impaired, MESRB alleges that at the June board meeting, the MPCA staff discussion of the implementation process that would be used to prevent overregulation was outside the rulemaking record. Again, as you can see on page 4 of the MPCA staff response to the MESRB petition, MESRB raised this issue during the rulemaking hearing and in the post-hearing comment period. The MPCA staff responded to the issue in the post-hearing response to comments by referring to the sonar documents and discussion of implementation in the sonar. The MPCA staff did not misrepresent the rulemaking record or go beyond the rulemaking record during the June board meeting. In conclusion, based on our review of the petition, our review of the June board meeting video, and the rulemaking record, the MPCA staff's June board meeting presentation accurately represented the written rulemaking record. The staff recommend that the board deny the petition. Thank you, and that concludes my summary.
Thank you, Jean, for that summary. And one additional topic that I'd like to further elaborate on is implementation.
Ms. Lauthammer.
Water quality standards are not implemented in a blunt manner. We believe flexibility is inherent and key to implementation. As staff described at the board meeting and in the sonar and the response to comments, there will be an extensive process associated with implementing the river eutrophication and total suspended solid standards, both for impaired waters assessment and also for developing permit requirements. In the rulemaking record and at last month's meeting, we described the permitting tools that provide flexibility for implementing discharge limits based on water quality standards. And flexibility is also integral to identifying impaired waters. That's the process that we call assessment. Again, as demonstrated in the rulemaking record, and Gene just pointed to that, the comparison of water quality data to the water quality standards is only the starting point for assessing for impairments. Assessment includes multiple steps that involve careful consideration of all of the available data to determine if a water body is impaired. So one example of how assessment flexibility is used is where low DO, dissolved oxygen, is detected in a river that's downstream of a wetland. The river would not be immediately listed as impaired for dissolved oxygen because the natural wetland process could be the reason for the low dissolved oxygen being measured in the river. Rather, additional data and information would be reviewed to determine if the low dissolved oxygen was a result of the wetland or if it was due to pollution. This is a process that we do right now in our assessment process and one that we would replicate when assessing for the water quality or the river eutrophication and total suspended solid standards. In fact, a significant benefit of the intensive watershed monitoring that we're able to do with the Clean Water Fund resources that we now have is that it provides a much more comprehensive data set that we can use when we apply standards, which helps us to make a much more nuanced and accurate decision about important matters such as impairment. I'd also like to note that we've successfully worked through implementation questions associated with the lake eutrophication standards, including the impaired waters assessment process, and that experience will further inform our implementation of river eutrophication and total suspended solid standards. So thank you again, Commissioner and board members, for the opportunity to respond to the petition. And staff would be happy to respond to any questions that you have about our response and recommendation.
Thank you, Ms. Lotthammer. Board members, now is your opportunity to ask questions of the staff. May I just begin by what you just described, Ms. Lotthammer, is an existing process that the agency utilizes in deriving impairment lists. There is no such document that lays it out in step one through X. Or is there, how does the flexibility that we utilize in making impairments incorporate the flexibility that we referenced in the hearing and the record for this rule? Does the language for the flexibility in deriving those lists currently exist?
Mr. Chair and members of the board, yes, it does. We have an assessment methodology that is a document that we prepare as we're doing the assessments every 2 years as a part of developing the impaired waters list. That assessment methodology has kind of a generic steps, and then as we assess for particular standards, we put the details of how that assessment occurs into that assessment methodology. And the details for that for the river or for the lake eutrophication standards were referenced in the record for this rulemaking. That assessment methodology is actually placed on public notice at the same time that the draft impaired waters list is placed on public notice. And there is a formal public notice and comment process that goes along with the methodology as well as the draft impaired waters list.
So, Ms. Lotthammer and Ms. Kessler, if it's relevant for you, but it sounds to me like the concern that Ms. Erb's petition raises is that the language is not present in the river eutrophication or TSS rule, but we utilize language in our other materials when we derive our lists and notice that to the public. Is that an accurate reflection of what occurs?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is. And I think an important additional point to point out is that in the assessment process, the Environmental Protection Agency has oversight over the list itself, so they have final approval of the list. The assessment methodology is the state's responsibility. That's part of kind of the separation of responsibilities between the federal and the state level. And so we have oversight, the agency has oversight in the development of that methodology and the implementation of that methodology. And again, we go through that notice and comment period to get feedback on that before we finalize the draft impaired waters list.
Thank you. Other questions? Dr. Drager.
Along those lines, on attachment one, comment line 216, subcomment number 23, for this issue of large and small streams and that assessment phase, you discuss a professional judgment group that's used to review the site information and make appropriate for each river reach. I'm curious if that professional judgment groups include scientists or representatives from the regulated community.
Ms. Lauthammer.
Mr. Chair and members of the board, yes, the process that we follow is that the state staff first review the data and information that we have and compare it to the water quality standards, develop our preliminary determination about assessments, and then we go through a process called the professional judgment group. And the professional judgment group includes local units of government and scientists that have familiarity with the data that we're using or the sites that we're assessing, and that is part of that decision-making process. So if a local unit of government was part of collecting the data or a local resource manager has familiarity with that site, we very much include them in the process to get that perspective and get that knowledge reflected in the decision-making process. If a regulatory facility or a regulated entity was collecting data that was being used as a part of the assessment process, we would welcome their participation in the professional judgment group as well as an entity that's knowledgeable about the data that we're using to make the decision. And then the final step then is the formal public notice and comment where anyone that's interested in this particular issue has the opportunity to comment on our impaired waters list.
Ms. Kessler, did you want to supplement that?
Just to clarify one thing, for assessment, we're actually evaluating and making determinations about the ambient or the background conditions. And whereas Shannon did mention a critical piece that we asked local resource managers to come in and participate in the professional judgment group, we purposely do not include ambient data that is directly downstream from wastewater treatment plants in the assessment process because that is not representative of background conditions. And so if there are data that are determined to be biased from wastewater dischargers, those would be eliminated from the assessment consideration prior to getting to the professional judgment group.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Riddle.
Yes, thank you. Would you please respond to the assertion that the BOD and DO flux are not used in Ohio and only used as indicators of concern in Montana?
Ms. Kessler.
Certainly. I think that it's just important to refresh our memories about different states establishing different water quality standards based on uses that they have prioritized. You've heard from us previously that we have established beneficial uses, and we have either numeric or narrative criteria that we use to determine compliance with protecting those uses. And other states like Montana and Ohio also have either numeric or narrative water quality standards to protect the beneficial uses that they have established. In the examples that have been raised today, Montana and Ohio have narrative criteria to protect against nuisance conditions, green and slimy algae conditions, and in order to implement those narrative criteria, they make numeric interpretations of the narrative criteria, and those interpretations involve looking at response variables, and that is documented in the record. In Montana, they consider both BOD, biochemical oxygen demand, and dissolved oxygen ranges when implementing their narrative criteria to control nutrients. In Ohio, they just use dissolved oxygen ranges. So there are documents in the record that demonstrate that the use of DO and BOD as response variables when thinking about impacts of nutrients on aquatic life are happening both in Montana for both variables and in Ohio for dissolved oxygen.
Ms. Kessler, would it be fair to summarize, though, that the use of those variables in other states may be different in form, is what, if I'm hearing you correctly, they are different in form than the proposal that the agency has adopted and is being petitioned today?
That is correct. They are different in form, and they should be different in form. I think the important point is that the framework that we are establishing, namely cause and response, is not unique to Minnesota, that is happening elsewhere, but the exact numbers that we are adopting are different, and they should be different because the biology and the water resources that we have here deserve unique protection based on the data which we have collected.
Thank you. I have one question, too, regarding the reference to the term geomorphology in our classification. If I would ask you to comment on the record's treatment of that question that's been raised previously. It was stated by Mr. Nelson that the agency has failed to respond to his comment regarding geomorphology. If I recall correctly, Ms. Lothimer, Ms. Kessler, there was statements in the rule and in our supporting documents regarding physical, biological, chemical, and other conditions of land use that are relevant. And so might you give me some response around how geomorphology relates to those terms?
Certainly, Commissioner and board members. During last month's discussion, we talked about the development of the river nutrient regions, which are the basis for the implementation of both the total suspended solids and the river eutrophication standards. Those river nutrient regions were established considering things like land use, geology, ecology, the potential for vegetation in those areas. And at the scale for which we have the data, we considered geomorphology. I think the question that has been raised talks about a much finer scale. And what we said last month and what is still true is that we are committed to refining the scale at which we implement the standards when we have the data that warrants more specific consideration at a finer scale.
Thank you. Mr. Ibarra, any questions for the staff?
No questions.
Thank you. Ms. Hang, any questions?
None at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Foley, did you have another comment or question you wanted to offer at this time?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it was a question of just a procedure a little bit. Are we going to allow the petitioner to actually make a statement following the staff so we can gauge just where they are relative to the answers and the document that's been referred to. So I personally would request that we allow them to at least have some time to address us now that they've heard officially the staff's response.
Understood. Thank you. Before we're doing so, any other board member questions? Dr. Drager?
So, again, back to attachment one, line 191, subcomment seven. This also reflects a comment that was in one of the letters that we've received. It's about the cost estimates. One of the letters stated that I believe it was the city of Albany that the MPCA's cost estimate was off by a factor of fivefold. This again makes some comment that the MPCA's low cost estimates being provided by the MPCA are not realistic and that it's thought that they might be too low by roughly a factor of three. The response from the agency is that they will consider cost information if provided with enough specificity. I guess that's an issue of partly burden of proof and also how we will be ground truthing that in the future so that we actually, if we're rebutting that the
the different cost estimates between the agency and the regulated community, at what point do we have an opportunity to actually see what the actual implications are? And if the regulated community was correct in that regards, then is there any recourse on their part?
Mr. Chair and members of the board, regarding the cost, the requirement that we have for the administrative rulemaking is to use our best available information to identify what the costs are of adopting and implementing the rule. And as noted in the response to comments, in the implementation, well, prior to the response to comments, in the implementation process, as we noted elsewhere in the rulemaking document, if one of the types of flexibility that's available through implementation is something called a variance, and we spoke about that at last month's meeting, that one consideration for variances from implementing the standard or ways to implement the standard is if there are prohibitive costs to implementing the standard immediately. And so that's one of the places where additional information about costs can be considered and more specific information about costs can be considered. So in the rulemaking process, we used the best available information that we had available to us. As we move forward with implementing the river eutrophication and total suspended solid standards, costs will be considered as the standards are implemented into permits, and discussions around cost and more up-to-date information will be considered during those processes, which have a public component to them as well. And any variance would come before the board, and the board would have the opportunity to examine that cost information at that time.
Thank you. Ms. Dr. Drager.
Just to follow up then on the recourse issue, and I know I haven't been on the board long, but I don't recall anyone coming before us with a variance just saying this will bankrupt our city or this is too much or our taxpayers can't afford us, you know, or we have. So I don't recall that, and perhaps we have had that, if that as a basis of variance. I'm not aware of it. But again, the recourse. And do we track this over time as we do this rulemaking and provide these cost estimates? Can the MPCA say over the last 30 years we've had a track record of being within, you know, 2%, 5%, you know, what they're saying here is 300% to 500% variation. So I'm just, do we have a track record to stand on?
And Dr. Drager, before Ms. Kessler, I'll just comment the last variance I recall the board deciding was on the Mesabi Nugget project in northeastern Minnesota, I believe it's in late 2012. So it's been a while since there's been a decision, but we've had none on municipal wastewater facility in my time on the board. Ms. Kessler.
Chairman and board members, I would just say that the process for obtaining a variance is clearly laid out in both state and federal regulations, and there are a number of factors that people can apply for a variance under, one being that the implementation of a discharge limit based on a water quality standard would cause undue hardship and economic difficulty, social and economic hardship to a community. And we do have experience implementing that, specifically in the distant past, we had a number of variances for phosphorus for small towns across Minnesota. And the way that the Clean Water Act works is that when technology and economics combine that such that a facility can't meet it, a variance is an appropriate tool. And then over time, the economics and the technology evolve or change such that new treatment technologies become more affordable or become viable for different types of facilities. And the Clean Water Act recognizes that variances need to be reconsidered and that the situation may change. So we've previously used variances in more than 30 occasions, but we have not renewed a number of variances because the reconsideration of those factors were such that it was not warranted. We recognize that going forward, we will use that tool if appropriate. Another tool that we're using a lot is a schedule of compliance that requires facilities to demonstrate that they meet the water quality standards as soon as possible, and knowing what the technology is in those cases is more certain. We do track variances, and we do consider costs with regard to variances. I would just respond by saying that I can't speak to whether or not we were 300% off, but a number of assumptions have to go into the
creation of costs for hundreds of facilities across the state, and the determination about what technology is appropriate and how much it'll cost in a given situation is very unique. So it's a challenge.
Thank you. Additional questions or comments from board members? Seeing none, Ms. Wafel, Mr. Lane, would you like to have an opportunity to respond? Thank you. Ms. Wafel and Mr. Lane have returned to the table for those listening, and welcome, please. Are there questions from board members first, or perhaps what we'll do, Ms. Wafel, is give you an opportunity to respond, and then if you would answer any additional questions, we would appreciate that.
That sounds great. And if you're okay with that, I'm going to make a couple comments, and then Mr. Lane may or may not add
very well
things if I don't
yep.
get it all in.
Thank you.
I'm going to try to stay to that same structure that I used earlier, sort of the three general areas, and just make some really brief comments on what was said. You know, the first point was whether or not those issues that we had raised earlier, whether they were being addressed. And, you know, what we've seen, I think, throughout this entire process, and I think that, you know, the staff members brought up was that, you know, there's been a lot of documentation out there. There's been a lot of discussion about this peer review has said this. And, you know, MESRB's raised a lot of questions, and we've brought out a whole bunch of documents. Our basic fundamental point is that even though there's a lot of documents out there, those very specific questions, we're not, you know, we're just looking for a page and line cite on here's where it says that this BOD or DO flux test is okay. And, you know, I used to litigate large law cases, and sometimes what you'd see in a lot of these is you'd see burying things in paper, and I kind of feel like these issues are getting buried in the paper when we're just simply looking for, you know, on in very fundamental questions on where is it okay to be using the BOD or the DO flux? You know, just give us a line and page number, and we're not seeing that. We're seeing a lot of paper, but we're not seeing that. The second thing on the Montana and Ohio issue, getting to this, I think that in some ways I was trying to say the same thing that Commissioner Stein said much more eloquently, and that was that they do have different approaches, and they do because they have different conditions. And our point that we're trying to make here is that, yes, you know, to the extent that they do use this at all, it is radically different than what Minnesota's doing. And therefore, they shouldn't be pointed to as scientific support for what Minnesota's trying to do. So that's what we were trying to get at. And then third on the variance issue, you know, our biggest concern there is that, I mean, I think you just heard the preceding discussion about this, and as this process has gone along, there's been more and more discussion. We can use, you know, site-specific, we can use the variance, and it gets back to, we think we need to get the standards right in the first place, rather than rely so much, you know, rather than putting into place standards that may end up with significant amounts of impaired waters if you don't use special processes and variances. And so I think that sort of the discussion of all these opportunities for that happen go to our point that we think that there are just problems with the underlying standard.
Mr. Lane, any additional comments?
Yeah, just additionally, I think the point raised by staff regarding the Dr. Foley's question regarding the Montana and Ohio use of DO flux pretty much supported our statement. They are not used in the same manner. They're used as in narrative criterion. These are numerical criteria. And they're not used in, at least I heard in Ohio's case, in relation to nutrient impairment at all. Also, get to Elizabeth's comment number three about variances, and I heard this also from staff, variances are a temporary fix. I'm not as familiar with EPA's requirement on those, but on time table for how long a variance is applicable. But I think what I heard from staff is that it also is a temporary situation and that it just brings it back to the table at a later date. The assumption being that technology catches up to the economics, that's not necessarily the case. What if economics or technology doesn't catch up with the economics after the period of that variance?
Thank you. Board members, questions? Dr. Foley.
Yeah, sir, just to pursue that, Montana and Ohio, you've seen the attachment to response that the staff has under number 14. It's pretty specific. I mean, there's a lot of specific information there that also speaks to the background basis for their thinking and proposal. So how is it that you continue to assert that there isn't data or peer review that would allow them to propose this the use of the standard? Admittedly, narrative is different than specific numerical, but they're both utilized. They're just utilized in a different way. Ours, at least as proposed in Minnesota, is more specific. So how is it that you can continue to assert that there's not information that allows the staff to put it into a numerical standard versus a descriptive one?
Mr. Olson or Ms. Wafel? Excuse me, Mr. Lane.
Confused me there. Sorry. Well, a couple of things, and this, I think, goes back to one of the earlier comments about the Ice Cream Marcus report, first off, and that is cited by the agency, but it is a circular reference if this agency cites its own publication and is a little bit different than having an outside peer review. A, first look at those applications and then look at them, how they're being used in this narrow numerical criteria. Again, and then tying that to the Montana and Ohio use of those standards, if they're being used differently, then that use has not been peer reviewed. And so I guess that's somewhat MESRB's message here is don't take our word for it. We would prefer that it be an independent peer review outside of MPCA circles, and you know we realize that EPA also gets referenced a lot, and I'm not sure that you know having this method reviewed by EPA is necessarily an independent peer review either.
I can tell you, I like to quote my own articles as often as I can, but and I've seen that thousands and thousands of times, and I'm not making light your answer, but I think there's a lot of specifics that the staff has given me here. I had, as you know, I'm the only no vote from last month, and so I had reservations. This has been this discussion and your petition has helped me to frame in my own mind what's the background and where we're going on this, but I find your answer a little bit hollow on that one, 'cause this article published in a peer-reviewed journal, has been out there for 13 years, and you know, different states use this stuff in different ways, but our way is our way, and their way is their way, and I'm not having as much difficult with it as I was last month. You haven't convinced me that they haven't given a thoughtful deliberation on the use of the information and the data. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wayful. Mr. Lane.
Thank you.
Board members, is there any desire to hear anything further from the staff? Otherwise, I would return. Dr. Drager.
I'm sorry. What was the name of the author of that 2001 paper?
Ms. Kessler is coming to the table, and one of the authors is seated in the front row.
Board members, is this... I need to mute. Okay, sorry.
Ms. Kessler.
Board members, the name of the article is Establishing Relationships Among Nutrient Concentrations, Phytoplankton Abundance, and Biochemical Oxygen Demand in Minnesota Rivers, and it was published in the Journal of Lakes and Reservoir Management in 2001 by Steve Heisgree and Howard Marcus.
Thank you. Board members, we just want to quickly review the timeline or the relevant legal standard here, and then like to take the vote so Ms. Hang can continue. Just a couple more minutes, please.
Thank you, Chair, Board members. I just want to remind you that you did make a final decision at the last board meeting. So what you're here today before you is the petition for stay and reconsideration. As I outlined earlier, in order to grant a petition for stay, you have to find irregularities in the hearing, errors of law, or newly discovered material issues of fact that could not have been discovered prior to the board or commissioner's final decision, and that it was so important that it would have altered the outcome of the decision. In addition, under Statute 116, again, very similar, but it says that the agency must not reopen, rescind, or reverse absent either a two-thirds vote or, again, finding a irregularity in the hearing, error of law, or a newly discovered material issue of fact.
Thank you. Members, the staff resolution before us is to deny the petition. You've got the recommendation. Before you, I'd ask if there's no further discussion, I'd call for a motion. Mr. Riddle.
Yes, I move that we deny the petition for a stay and reconsideration.
Motion been made to deny. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Dr. Sampson. Any further discussion on the motion?
I just wanted to make one comment, if I could.
Ms. Sampson.
At the beginning of last month's meeting, we reintroduced the board members. And I just wanted to take a moment and go on the record again and reintroduce myself a little bit. And since I was absent, explain sort of a little bit of my process and so to give support to my vote when we get to that point. Although I would not characterize myself as an expert in this particular area, I do have a PhD in environmental engineering with a focus in aquatic chemistry. And as I listened to the board meeting broadcast, I took care to think very hard about these questions about BOD and DO as response variables. And I think it is okay for me to say that from my background and my perspective and understanding of the chemistry of these particular parameters, it makes perfect sense to me to use those particular parameters as response variables. So that's why I did not raise any questions when the board was talking about this now, and I probably would not have raised the question last time except to perhaps clarify a little bit had I been present at the meeting. So just wanted to point that out and go on record, because I do think we, and looking around at my fellow board members, we have a pretty amazing board with a lot of experience and wisdom to bring to bear. So just wanted to point that out since I was absent, and that might raise a question in some people's minds as my ability to vote coming from a good reasoning standpoint today. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sampson. Dr. Drager.
So I would just like to make a comment before I vote as well. I think we heard earlier about the communications efforts that the MPCA is doing, and I thought Dr. Foley made a very kind of wise comment about the use of communication and its role in an open and democratic society, which I think was an interesting commentary. And so we're charged with the certain with a large degree of both authority and responsibility for these resources, and I find it very troubling that we have heard some testimony today about undermining the trust in the institution. I mean, for the well-being of our state and our country, we need to keep that trust in the people who are setting these regulations and this authority. And so I just hope that we can continue to communicate, keep an open dialogue with those regulated people, do what's necessary to amend the bridge and to develop the trust. And also, again, with also as we checked back with the stormwater regulations and what impact they've had, we have to check back and make sure that we are making the progress that we hope to make with water quality and not bankrupting the communities, many of which in greater Minnesota are already under a great deal of stress. And we need to be balancing the public good we're doing with any public harm that could result as a result of making these decisions today, and just hope that the regulated community continues to see this as a place where they can go to have an open and fair discussion of those opportunities, and that this agency as well stands as that kind of an institution for our state.
Thank you, Dr. Drager. Any further comments? Seeing none, I'm going to call the question and begin with those on the phone. Ms. Hang, can you identify yourself and your vote on the question?
This is Paku Hang, and I vote aye or yes to deny the motion.
Thank you, Ms. Hang. On the phone, Mr. Ibarra, please identify yourself and your vote.
Again, David Ibarra, Minnesota Pipe Trades, and I, too, vote to deny the motion, the petition. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ibarra. Dr. Sampson?
Vote aye to deny the petition.
Dr. Drager?
Vote aye.
Dr. Foley?
Aye.
Mr. Jensen is absent. Mr. Riddle?
Aye.
And the chair votes aye. There being 7 out of 9 board member votes, there is a sufficient majority to deny the petition. Those of you who have been on the phone patiently with us this morning, thank you very much. To the members of the public and to the agency staff, thank you for your presence and contributions to this meeting. I'd call for a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Moved by Dr. Sampson, second by Mr. Riddle. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those in
favor.
Opposed, same sign. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you. This is-